I would like to open the Senate Interim Committee on Economic Development Agency Oversight. As you noticed when you came in, we have a very aggressive schedule today. In no small measure, it's because this is a large and complex agency. This will be the first of six meetings on the Senate side. And for those of you that did not find issue areas in this first agenda, you will find them in the rest of the comprehensive work plan. And if you have issues, it would be the chair's preference that you raise them with the chair rather than emailing out your frustration that you weren't included. I know we have public comment today, and in addition to the schedule that was published, we're going to, under the small business section, have a quick update on the OLCC methodology. Given that so many of the OLCC stores are small businesses, we're going to have just a quick update on their methodology for doing a review of compensation for agents. That shouldn't take very long. So with that, we have the House Interim Committee on Economic Development meeting with us jointly today. We could that way both glean the benefit of the agency oversight since the close of session. We are going to adopt our rules on the Senate side, and then the House Committee will adopt their rules. And then I'm going to ask each member of the panel to introduce themselves, the district they represent, and a short statement on what they hope to achieve from their service on the committee. So with that, I'm going to call to order the Senate Committee, and I think you have before you the rules. Are there any comments on the rules?
No comments.
Any objection?
No objection.
Then they are adopted as offered. And now I'll turn the meeting over to Representative Lim.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. And it is our pleasure joining our committee meeting with the Senate. And I do appreciate very much. And as a matter of fact, I'm a strong believer that the Trade and Economic Committee should be a joint committee according to the statute already written in the law. And hopefully next session when we come back, we'd like to have a joint committee together by the approval of the President and also the Speaker of the House. With that, I'd like to open the meeting of the House Interim Committee on Economic Development at this time, and I'm sure you have the copy of the Interim Committee rules. I'm sure you read it, and do we need to have a motion at this time?
Yes.
I'd like to so move. Any objections to adopting the rules? If not, then the House rules is adopted.
Great. I am going to start with my good friend and former House colleague, Representative Tomei, if you'd like to start the introductions at that end.
Thank you, Senator. I will. I'm Carolyn Tomei, State Representative for House District 41, which is Milwaukee and Southeast Portland, West Portland, East Portland, Selwood. And I'm delighted to be on this committee. My district is short on family wage jobs, and that's one of the things that all of Clackamas County and certainly Southeast Portland is looking towards. So great interest to my constituents in this committee. Thank you.
We're coming around this way with the introductions.
Right, thank you. Representative Kim Thatcher, Representative Kaiser, and Newburgh and St. Paul. And economic development is of great interest to me, not only for my district, but for the whole state, because that is how we will get the revenues we need for state services.
Representative Chuck Burley, House District 54, the City of Bend. This is my first time on this committee. I look forward to learning a great deal being here. This is my first term. Coming from the forestry sector and seeing what that's done to our rural communities, I've got a great deal of interest in what we can do throughout the state to help promote good jobs and good wages.
I'm Senator Lori Moss Anderson from Fairwood Village, Troutdale and Gresham, and I live in a district that is growing and wants to attract good family wage jobs and promote business, and therefore this committee will be very important to me. I've been having a lot of input on the inefficiencies as well as the efficiencies that they would like to see in OECD, and so hopefully we'll be looking at ways to make that department even better, or make it better. Amen.
I'm David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. I represent four counties, Umatilla, Marl, Union, and Waugh County, kind of the northeast portion of the state. The folks down here in the valley have been awash with water, flooded out. We're dry out there in our part of the country still. We want you to start pumping some of your water over to our part of the country. And so my interest, and I think really is the whole, if you look at the long-term value of this, where we're going in the state of Oregon, we have groundwater problems. Water is going to be an absolute crucial element to economic development. And because with almost all plants, if you have people coming in, population trends, we're going to have more water. And I'm just going to ask you folks, where are we going to get it from?
Representative Lim.
Yes, thank you. My name is John Lin, and I served in the Senate 2.5 terms. Now I came to the House, and some people ask me why are you going down instead of going up. But there's no such thing as going down and up. So serving the people is most important. When I was a senator, I served in the Trade and Economic Committee as a member, vice chair, and a chair. Now in the House, I'm serving this
prestigious?
Yes, prestigious. And the committee of the Trade and Economic Committee. Since the early 90s, our state economically went down after the timber industry going down, still we are struggling to create more jobs, and then still we are 1 or 2% lower than national average. Somehow we need to get it back at least even par with the national economy in creating more jobs. You know, hopefully we try to identify the problems and how could we improve the situation. That's why we are here. I'm glad I'm working with all the members together here again. And I'm serving the Gresham area, mostly the southern part of Gresham. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm Representative Greg Smith. I represent the best half of Senator Nelson's district. I guess the reason I'm on this committee is I screwed up the Ways and Means process so bad that this was my punishment is to be placed here. On this committee, I'm here to serve Senator Johnson and Representative Lim as they take us forward into the next session. So thank you for having me here.
Brad Avakian in Northeast Washington County. And Madam Chair, I'd like to just note for the record, for your benefit, Senator Nelson, that some of us in the valley get a little touchy about being referred to as all wet, washed up, and flushed out. But we'd be happy to tilt the state and send some of that water south if we could. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Paul Holby, I'm from District 8, which is South Eugene and South Central Wayne County, and it's an honor to serve on this committee. Very important that we have a strong economy and good jobs in this state. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm Betsy Johnson. I have the privilege of representing five counties in Senate District 16, Columbia, Clatsop, Tillamook, Washington County in Greater Banks, and Sauvie Island in Multnomah. mine is a district that was a natural resource-dependent district, now changing dramatically both in demographics and in its source of good jobs. And so we're struggling with trying to figure out how do we maximize our potential in a very highly dynamic economic situation. Many of my counties have not been part of the economic revitalization of some parts of the state, and we're struggling trying to figure out how to create good jobs for the folks that live there. So with that, I am now going to invite up for his first appearance in his new capacity, Director Repine, and appointee Repine, and the team from Oregon Economic and Community Development, who are going to give us a general agency overview. From the time the session ended in August, there have been a number of changes and new faces, and I would ask Mr. Repine and the OECDD team to come forward.
That would be
you.
Yeah, no, I just need to be a little confused.
Ah,
thank you.
Ready?
Yeah, I can roll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, I am Bob Repine, Director of Oregon Economic and Community Development. I'm probably going to get penalized for going back to Oregon Housing and Community Services, so if there's a pot I have to start feeding, you might as well go ahead and start collecting that money now. It is a pleasure for me to be here. Effectively, I have not taken a job yet. I will be over there on a full-time basis on March 6th. So we're starting to make the transition from my agency over to Economic. A lot of work still at my shop to still get closed down and completed in the next 20 days. So looking forward to being there. I wanted to point out that through this transition period, I have been working with Mike Salzgeber, who I want to mention to you. Most of you are aware of. He's been very skillful in the interim working with this agency. Much of the work that has been accomplished under his short tenure is very evident with both in the quality and the demeanor of people in the department and products that I think will advance much of the issues that you as committee members are interested in seeing advanced. We'll be seeing and hearing about many of that after I finish. Lynn Beaton also will be staying on with me to work internally with the agency, so I still maintain what I believe is a very strong core group of administrators to help guide me and help me and assist in with the new evolution of where we go with economic community development. In the audience, there are many of our senior managers. I don't want you to believe I brought them because I was looking for a cheerleading squad, and that wasn't the case. Because the breadth of issues that you're interested in today, I felt it's not the legislative process where sometimes having people sitting around is not looked at as very favorable. I want you to know that they're sitting here because they have offered a tremendous amount of expertise and knowledge about many of these programs that you're going to hear in a very short 5 or 6 minute presentation. So for the pleasure of the committee, if there are issues that are more germane or of substance, we brought the experts who can speak to those issues and try to help define your questions. So with that, I just want to let you know I'm pleased to be here. I'm looking forward to the Senate conference process. It will be on April 6th. So for those who have ever done wrong in the legislative process, mark your calendars, because that will be the day of salvation. But I hope that my time at Oregon Housing will show you that I'm a very committed public servant, as many of you are in your roles. I want to do the best thing for Oregon. I think the opportunity that the governor presented me to take over this agency or be involved with this agency is very timely, because I think that Oregon is at a tremendous point in their life of the state, and we need to be moving in a very productive, forward manner. Many of your comments that you talk about the interests of small business and jobs and winning wage jobs are very important. We not lose sight of those issues. And so I commit to you that those will be the issues that we will be working on, and being as cooperative as any group can be relative to questions and issues that this assembly and body are interested in knowing about this agency.
Thank you very much, Mr. Repine. Any questions for Mr. Repine?
Madam Chair.
Representative
Wilk. I just want to say that we served together in the House and you're in the House, and it's my pleasure that we are able to work with you sometime in the future on this issue. Just want to say thank you for that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. All right, with that, Mr. Salzgeber.
Chair Johnson, members of the Joint Committee, good afternoon. It's good to be back and see you all again. First, I'd like to thank Director and soon-to-be incoming Director Repine for his kind comments. But I would really like to acknowledge also the team of folks that we have in the agency that has really led the way on this. I've offered some suggestions on process and other things, but these are the content experts that know this agency upside down and backwards, and without them we could not have made the progress that we have made in just 6 months. You have a packet in front of you that Deputy Director Beaton's memo summarizes for you. It has in there some things I'll steam through very quickly. A working draft of a new, what I call the poster, the mission and strategic objectives for the agency going forward. A couple of pages on summarizing our key programs and what those are and how they operate. You have a couple of charts in there, and you will see
that the color is starting to seep back into light into our presentation again, but there's some color graphs that you can see that show both by program type and funding type the allocation, the funds that we have, and then there's also a chart that shows that the funds over which our Economic Development Commission has authority to allocate, those allocation decisions are in there as well. And there is a presentation that will segue to what Coral Parker, our Central Operations Division Manager, will brief you on, and then a list of a roster of our Economic Development Commission members. So with that, let me very quickly go back to the end of June 2005, when Director Brantley retired and the governor called and asked if I would serve in an interim role as the department director. He gave me three, in Intel speak, there's one thing you learn on your first day and you never forget. It's called an AR. It's an action required. And when you get an AR, you actually get to choose whether to accept it or not, but once you do, you are bound by oath and blood to get it done. I was given three primary ARs by the governor. One was to complete the legislative session for the agency and get us an operating budget. The second AR was to work with the legislature in navigating the interim and in strengthening the position of the agency during the interim. And then finally, he asked me to begin strategic planning for the department so that we were clear about our mission, clear about our objectives, in priority order, and had the beginnings of a work plan underneath of that, and that we were doing the outreach necessary to get that done. I'm proud to say that with the team that is here with us today, we have accomplished these three ARs. Strategic planning is still underway, as you might imagine, but we have listened very carefully to the feedback we received during the regular session. The key areas for improvement that we were identified for the department were in the areas of focus and priority, responsiveness, the need to be responsive and to be communicating with folks in a more clear and proactive way, to be more clear about who our partners were and how we cooperated with them, and then finally to make ourselves more efficient. In July, we began a process that we called the Division Program Review Process. In part, it was to educate me as a new to, bear in mind, when I was named acting director, I'd been with the agency less than 6 months. And although I've worked with the agency for the better part of 25 years, it's very different when you're on the other side of the door, the other side of the ledger, being asked to make decisions on its behalf. So we went through a process of division program reviews, which were in part to educate me, were in part to calibrate and educate our senior team, the division managers that had to run the agency on a day-to-day basis, and in part to provide cross-jurisdictional, cross-division information so that we knew what was behind us and what resources we had, what our objectives were, and how we intended to get them done and how we were performing. It was a new process as far as I could tell for the agency. They embraced it very well, and we have just scheduled our second round of them. In fact, we're going to use those as an opportunity to get Director Repine integrated and calibrated very quickly so he can step in on March 6th running as I'm sure will anyway, but it's an opportunity to get that underway very quickly. We also used the division program review process to set the stage for strategic planning, and we used each one of those meetings, every member of the division was present. So at the end of those meetings, when they would do the presentations about here's our objectives, here are the issues, here's what we've accomplished, here's where we get our funds, here's how we allocate them, here's how we're performing in our budget. At the end of that meeting, the staff did a brainstorm about what they thought the strategic objectives for the agency should be. And then in October, the senior staff went off at an all-day off-site hearing or meeting, and we reassembled all of that information and summarized it as I mentioned, in the document that I call the poster that has at the top the Rhodes working draft. And that document looks like this. Has a revised proposed mission statement for the department, which we believe summarizes what the agency both does and is expected to do in the years to come. Then we brainstormed, actually from a list of over 40 different proposed objectives for the agency, we put them in buckets, if you will, and started the process of winnowing them down into a shorter list. I'm a believer in working from a very short list and having a fairly detailed plan underneath of that. What you will see from here, this is the third draft of this document. Now, we've been shopping it around as our commission meets around the state. We send it out to members of the communities in which we're going to meet and solicit input. I think most of you have seen it or received it. And these are not yet in priority order, but they are our cut at suggesting what we think the strategic objectives for the department should be going forward. So I know you can read faster than I can talk, but to summarize it for the audience, certainly investing in workforce development. When we talk to our businesses, we hear over and over again that that is the number one issue facing them in a recovering economy. Number two is to promote innovation and global competitiveness through the development of Oregon's industry clusters, and we'll hear more about that later on today. Three, we want to continue to invest in community infrastructure and industrial lands work to stimulate private investment and a healthy economy or environment. Four, we want to continue to work with our sister agencies to reduce regulatory barriers to a competitive business climate. We want to continue to market Oregon's advantages. We've seen great motion forward, great results already from a fairly small investment on the state's part in Brand Oregon, for example. And so we have considered that an important objective to continue to pursue. And then because the Arts and Cultural Commission is a part of our organization, we are looking to use that as a tool for advancing economic development. We heard during session how important arts-related infrastructure development is. It is an important criteria when businesses are looking to Oregon to invest because it's something their employees care about. So we are going to do that. You're going to see more about the economic side of arts and culture in the months to come. Chris Darcy and her team are working on that.
And Mr. Soskin, just to interrupt you and to reassure the Senate side of the committee, that will be an issue taken up in one of the future meetings that are coming up between now and the beginning of session.
Yes, Chair Johnson, we will be focusing on that through your oversight committee, and also our Economic Development Commission and the Arts and Culture Commission will be meeting in March in Gresham and with a focus on arts and culture. So there's a
Mr. Stutz, give me a question. Senator Nelson.
Just a quick one. I mean, on the strategic objectives, my introduction was about water. I really think you need to put water in here as one of your objectives. You want to do all this stuff, you're going to have water to do it. Where are we going to get the water? To me, that's an absolute crucial question that we have in the state of Oregon right now.
I'll take the prerogative of the chair on the Senate side to say that we have one of the sessions in the work plan, and I will get the full work plan out to you guys just as soon as we finish the last refinements on it, that speaks to economic development and infrastructure. And I will make a commitment now to include a section on water in that, and we'll specifically invite in some experts who can speak to that issue and perhaps instruct the conversation.
Thank you.
And our very capable staff, Mr. Keller, is making a note of that, so that's a done deal. Representative Smith.
Chair Johnson, thank you very much. Mike, it's very good seeing you.
You too, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much for staying on with Director Repine. Director Repine, you've got a good one in both these individuals next to you. How do these six objectives assist small business?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I think what you're going to see is, I mentioned the detailed work plan underneath of this. Each one of these objectives in the detailed work plan will probably have between 7 and 10
specific action items that will be called out to support achieving the objective. And with that, they will have an owner assigned to them. We will identify the resources necessary to accomplish it. We will identify a timeline within which we expect to accomplish it. We will identify our performance measures, the measure of success, how did we hit it or not. And that will be a part of a detailed work plan that we at the staff level will be looking at every month to make sure we're making progress. I fully expect that small business support will knit its way through a number of these objectives. And while we don't have the detailed matrix done yet for that work plan, we will be happy to share it with you as soon as we have that first draft included, and I fully expect you'll see that in there. We are already, given the governor's direction to Director Repine, and as a result of our own internal discussions in the last few months, we've already begun repositioning the organization for a beefed up support of small business anyway.
You know, one of the things I might suggest to Chairman and Chair Johnson is as you work forward and we talk about small business, the one thing I'm not sure we have is a true definition that we all mutually agree upon is this is what we view small business is. Because one of the concerns I wasn't able to tackle during session, and I think it was a major impediment to moving our state forward, was making sure we're all on the same page in terms of what we envision when we talk about small business. For me, it's mom and pop on Main Street. For Representative Tomei, it may be something very different. For Chair Lynn, it may be something different. And as you work through the process, I'd strongly encourage you to have a definition of what is a small business owner.
That's excellent.
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I might say that we are acutely aware of the importance of small business within the agency and its importance to the economy, and you'll be hearing more from us about it. The other thing, so this is the draft that we are working from, and I will leave it with you for we welcome and solicit, and in fact, implore you to give us your feedback. The goal here is that by December of 06, we will be marching together, agency, governor's office, legislature, into the 07 session with a very clear and unified understanding about this agency and what its objectives are and how we're going to get it done. So that's the purpose here. Also, during our summer vacation, we've been restructuring and repositioning the agency a little bit. When we started in the end of June, the agency actually had 8 or 9 standing divisions. We, in meeting the request to be efficient, we have moved to compress that into a smaller number. We now have 5 standing divisions, and we've combined some, created a new one to meet the innovation and economic needs that the state has, and so we've been working on that as well. Finally, Chair Johnson, you asked us if we would highlight the funding, and then I'll set the stage for Cora to talk to you about the statutory review. But if you look at these two graphs right here, this is, again, just an opportunity to ground you. It's what I asked each division manager to know about their own division and what we expect to know about the whole agency. One, you can see our total funding source, $168.4 million for this biennium, is the legislatively adopted budget. We have it segmented for you by program and by fund type. You can see where we get our funds and where they go. And so the bulk of them come from other non-limited funds, and most of those go to community development. Then it goes down the line. You can see our agency, for example, is very tiny amount, less than 1% comes from general fund support.
Mr. Shelsky, I interrupt you for a moment. Representative Smith. Mike, on this committee, 4 of us are Ways and Means folks. Can we talk a little bit about what other funds, non-limited means?
Pardon me?
There's 4 members on this committee are Ways and Means. The rest are not. Can we talk about what other funds, non-limited means?
Thank you for the record, Cora Parker, the Central Operations Division Manager for the Department. I assumed that Mike would look at me for this question. Other funds, non-limited, is a technical term. It's one of the ways we slice and dice funding structures. Typically, it's characterized by revolving loan funds is one example. But basically, funds that come in and go out of a department in a way that you don't want to have a specific cap or limit on what those funds are. PERS is an example of as payments go out to PERS recipients. Those are non-limited other funds because the nature in which they come in and go out is not predictable necessarily in a way that you would want this body to, in a biennial basis, have to cap and constantly have to go back to an emergency board, etc., in order to release additional expenditure limitation. For our agency, it is largely revolving loan funds, those funds that have been initially funded by bonding sources, etc., or other sources, and then the repayment structure is literally repayment of loans, etc., that come in and recycle throughout the agency over and over and over again.
Thank you.
Chair Johnson, with that, actually, I think I'm done, and I think Mr. Repine had some additional comments, and then we'll turn it over to Cora.
Can I recognize Mr. Repine?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate it. For the record, I am Bob Repine, Director of Economic Community Development. I just want to comment on a couple of things that Mike had mentioned, and let you all know also, when the announcement was made by the Governor's Office, immediately Mike and Lynn and I met. We have spent exceptional time together kind of getting the lay of the land of the agency. And one of the pieces that I was very impressed with is their strategic planning process. And I want to assure you, this is a strategic planning process similar to what I've gone through now three terms in my agency. It is a very open, visual way to explain the mission to people and give everybody the idea of where the direction is. You know, Representative Smith saw it during the Ways and Means process and some other ones last year. This is the skeleton, I guess is the way to describe it, what you see, and then what we will do is start adding the kind of meat to the bones. And that's where, as Megan mentioned, there could be as many as 6 to 7 little targets that will evolve, that will answer to what those larger objectives are that are listed in the strategic plan. One of the things I want to caution my staff and myself is, we have an opportunity to build a real opportunity to build a strong strategic planning process. And I've cautioned them not to be over anxious about trying to take on everything all at once, because too many items sometimes creates a big failure or a disappointment in many people. So being strategic as you pick those items too is very mindful. That's not to say that you are not going to deal with other issues. As I've portrayed my strategic plan in my agency, we still have hundreds of things to do with housing, but we have brought certain issues to the forefront to spend extra quality special attention to get things going on quicker, sooner, so we can show results in the same fashion. So I see that this strategic plan will be much like that, and I thank Lynn and Mel for bringing me into that discussion early. And those discussions continue today, as I'm here today, and it was a staff meeting once this week, and I'm starting to meet with a series of the divisions to understand, as Mike mentioned, the kind of the interaction of where they are in some of their strategic thinking right now. So I just want to let you know that we have been already engaged in this discussion. This is not a surprise to me. Many of you have seen this earlier than I have, but it was very refreshing to see the leadership role that Mike and the others have taken to get this first cut to the level they have. I think they've done a very good job at it.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Senator. Actually, I have three questions. I don't know if you want them one at a time or take off.
All right.
One, on your working mission statement, it says, we prepare communities. Are you referring to investing in infrastructure? What do you mean? It's kind of a nebulous statement there.
Chair Johnson, Representative Thatcher, what that means is if you look at number 3 on the strategic objectives, that really calls out that community level interaction. We work with communities to help them prepare themselves for a strong business investment. In this case, in the case of our department, that usually falls into the area of infrastructure development, so water, roads, sewer, utilities, etc.
water, Senator Johnson, or Senator Nelson.
Yeah, at least my second question. You did mention roads. I was wondering, I assume when talking about infrastructure that it does include roads, and yes. You did mention that, so I appreciate that. And my third question, final one, do you have any particular, I noticed the mission statement's laid out, strategic objectives are laid out. Are you working on any measurable benchmarks to know whether your strategic objectives are being, are they effective or not?
Chair Johnson, Representative Thatcher, yes, we are. We already have 9 performance measures that the department is accountable to the legislature and to the governor on right now, and we'd be happy to provide you with a list of those. As I mentioned, when we develop, we already have a first draft of some of the detailed work underneath each objective, but we had to change some because the objectives changed, so we're rewriting some of the other ones now. Each one of those will have a matrix that lines out the, identifies the objective, and then each action item that will be employed to support that objective will be called out, and one of the columns in that matrix will be the performance measure. And we'll be happy to share that with you as soon as we get them.
Thank you.
Okay. Yes. I'd like to know more about this number 2, promote innovation and a global competitiveness of Oregon's industry clusters. And could you give us a little update on the international trade division, what they are, where they are, how we are going to face the international competitiveness? Just give us some brief overview on it, please.
Chair Johnson, Representative Lim, one of the organizational things we have done in this year is to create a new division called the Innovation and Economic Strategies Division. When I was in the private sector, one of the observations I had of the agency is it would be nice, when I worked in Congress, we used to have and still do have the Congressional Research Service, and CRS does an enormous amount of work to do issue evaluation and basically data gathering and analysis that helps inform Congress about what issues are in front of them, what are coming over the horizon, and recommending policy options that Congress may consider to address those issues. I have a mini version of that in mind when we created IES, Innovation and Economic Strategies. So we have a new division. That is going to be the data gathering, data analysis, and policy recommending side of the agency. Not that other divisions will be excluded from that, but it will be the primary driver of that if it works right. The other part of that is, as you know, the legislature, at the governor's request, created under Senate Bill 838 and 853 a new Oregon Innovation Council, of which is to prepare for the legislature and the governor's consideration by the end of July a proposed innovation plan for the state of Oregon that will include an analysis of the competitive climate we're finding ourselves in as a state and making policy recommendations about how the state can respond to those and help businesses position themselves for success in a global economic environment. We are there now. And with that in mind, we also took the Business Development Division and the International Division and combined them into a single Business and Trade Development Division. And the purpose of that was that much as the word quality used to be called out by businesses, there was a quality assurance manager and there was a quality control division, there was quality, always calling it out. The fact of the matter is, in today's business world, quality is expected to be in whatever a successful business does. Well, in a global environment, international is just a part of the equation. It is there now, and it seemed to us to be no longer important to continue to call it out, and for administrative efficiencies, frankly, we felt there was advantage to be gained by combining the two under the umbrella of a single business development plan for the state of Oregon, of which there were domestic and international components. Now, the International Trade Commission, which is one of 8 commissions and councils our department supports, has, during the last fall and in December, reviewed a staff recommendation on a revised international business development plan that we adopted and are now implementing. And Ron Fox, who is the current is the division manager for business and trade development division, and I met with Trade Commission Chair Ron Reagan yesterday and for about 2.5 hours and stepped through with them how we are moving forward and implementing that plan. We have more work to do. Our goal is to have the plan, the administrative structure of it, fully in place by roughly the beginning of July, and you are already beginning to see elements of the program-related work become implemented right now. You're going to see a shift as a business development strategy from sort of opportunistic work to a priority focus in key geographies and key industry clusters that will provide the greatest return of investment on the taxpayer dollar spent. So that's the overview of the plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Does that end your portion of the presentation?
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Following adoption of our appropriation bill, we were directed to review all of the statutory direction to the department. And in line with what Senator Mona Sanderson and some of you have identified today, basically to streamline and make the department better as far as just effectiveness and ability to perform. Again, though, keeping in mind that mantra, that message of don't take on too much because you end up having a lot with not a lot coming out the end. We have basically adopted it. You've got in front of you, just for purposes if you want to follow along, a PowerPoint document if you'd like to. But basically the direction was to review all of our statutory direction and in line with what legislative goals are for the department, identify potential alternatives for making revisions to those statutes. Oh, by the way, do it with a stakeholder process so that we're not in a vacuum as we make recommendations to this body. And then ultimately for the commission to make recommendations to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee about making some changes that would basically consolidate and streamline processes. Our commission adopted a plan in November. The Joint Legislative Audit Committee adopted that same plan, approved it in January of this year, and we have also now adopted a communication plan. I didn't bring those documents for you today. If any of you would like copies of those, let Mr. Keller know and we'll get them to you via his office.
And I'm going to interrupt long enough to say that if a member requests, either from the House side or the Senate side, requests any documents that are offered today, I would ask the professional staff to make sure all members of both committees have them.
But basically the plan begins with an internal process. Rather than starting with a blank slate and saying, okay, let's dream up what it should look like and going to stakeholders and saying, what do you think? We committed to starting with an internal process, bringing forward what we're calling a forward review and response document, and then basically soliciting from stakeholders input on that document. It is not intended to be necessarily a set of recommendations. It really is that starting point that, okay, here's one way we can move. Now push and pull and prod and let's get out the other end with something that makes sense. And I don't have any expectations that we'll come out at the end with, you know, everyone believing exactly in the same focus, but we commit to actually bringing where we've got some of those opposing viewpoints or some of those tensions that we always hit in the economic development world, but that frankly we'll bring those forward so that during the legislative process you all will be able to just call those tensions out instead of them being behind the scenes and sort of buried from view as we talk about what we're doing. Our internal reviews are underway. Some themes are emerging as we go through those. There are a number of opportunities to consolidate and clarify some of those big picture directives that this body has given to the department. There are a number of instances where program language and duplication can be removed. Consistency of language can be improved throughout. Representative Smith talks about the definition of small business. Those are some of those things that, again, I think there are at least a couple of places in statute where our definition is slightly different for different agencies, and then different commissions have adopted different views of those as well. So we're looking at those kind of things as well. And then there are cases where we, over the years, have gotten to very detailed definitions of program minutiae that staff are believing there are some elements that, frankly, could be removed from statute and into administrative rules or some other areas. Some of those criteria issues, things that, because we've gotten to that minutiae level, every time the economy changes or it makes sense to make a shift, because it's in statute, we literally have to come back to this body, sometimes out of sync with what the economy actually is requiring of us, and go through that evaluation process again. So we're talking about, again, potentially removing some of that how-to and getting back to the bigger picture direction.
I am hopeful that by the time we get through this process on both the House and Senate side, that this committee might meet again jointly with our House colleagues with an idea of having a very thoughtful conversation with the department about what your recommendations are, with an eye towards offering legislation in the 07 session to get that run of statutes tidy, appropriate, timely, and do the things that you just laid out that I think will help strengthen our collective efforts in economic development. But I'd like us to meet again and see if between the House and the Senate we can agree on a package to go forward.
We would love that as an agency, I can tell you. Again, some of the themes that are emerging, just, again, removing that broad language and filling the gaps with rules and policies. But, again, recognizing that there probably will be some details that are necessary to retain in statute. Some of those, I don't know if you want to call them controversial or regulatory issues, or things that, frankly, this body has said, we want to do this, and no, it's not an objective of the department to have it be optional at any level. So that we certainly recognize that there will be an element that needs to remain at the statutory level. From a next steps perspective, again, we're in that internal review process right now. We're beginning to more formally engage some of our stakeholders. Our commission has identified subject topic leads. We'll be meeting with them over the course of the next few weeks, giving them a heads up on where we think we're headed, so that when we bring them that full review and response document in March, that they have an idea of what we were bringing for them. We're also going to kick off our communication plan. You'll see a web page that will go up in the very near term. We actually sat down and worked through an expectations document that will be delivered to stakeholders, so each of you will probably be receiving this. And basically, it's what we are committing to as we go through the process, but then also outlining what our expectations of stakeholders are, so that what we're clearly saying, this is how we would like to see you engage in the process, the kind of feedback, the forums that you have for feedback, et cetera. And sort of that, if we both hold up our end of the bargain, here's how we can get to a recommendation in the end.
Ms. Parker, my only observation would be, I hope this doesn't get so process-laden that we get lost. And it seems
Absolutely.
To be rich with process at this moment.
Absolutely. And Madam Chair, that has been one of the issues that our commission has identified for us as well. We truly are trying to keep it as simple as possible. I hear that mantra on a daily basis internally.
I would add, just for the benefit of our House colleagues, that each one of the Senate meetings, subsequent meetings between now and the interim, is going to include a brief review on how the agency is doing, a kind of an oversight on their timeline, and to see how they're doing in working through their run of statutes to do the things that Ms. Parker has outlined.
And just to speak to that again, what we are hoping to do is that process to be basically transparent from the outside, the stakeholder perspective, so that it truly is that we're taking care of that administrative and process-laden side of, internal to the department, so that we can run the process smoothly, so that we can solicit the information, we can organize it in a way that kicks up and is very simple, very easy to understand, and that on the outside it truly is transparent. So, and we've got an excellent team communication side, et cetera, that's working together to drive towards that.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Council. What's your process? Are you going to be working with other departments within the state to see where there's overlap?
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative Smith, we're looking at them as part of that stakeholder group. So in certain cases, we're starting to involve them already at a somewhat informal
you know, part of the process, but they were looking at them as stakeholders as we take recommendations out, as we put that response document out there, to bring them in and actually engage, just like any of you or any, or frankly any of the other groups that you're going to hear from today. We're looking at some of these groups as some of the major stakeholders as well.
Just a quick heads up.
Follow up, Representative Smith.
As you go through the process, that's probably one of the areas that I'm going to be looking at is you know, where do we have other departments who are performing similar functions, and what consolidation could be completed.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Thatcher.
I hear the word stakeholders being used a lot, and I'm wondering if any of these stakeholders would actually include businesses or members of the business community, and maybe you can elaborate on who you consider stakeholders.
Right. Madam Chair and Representative Thacker, actually our commission has adopted a fairly lengthy list, and again I didn't bring those documents for you today, but I certainly would be willing to get them, a fairly lengthy list of primary and secondary stakeholders. The business side is always more difficult to get to because you literally don't want to blanket every single business in the state, but we're trying to work through some of the larger groups, the Oregon Business Council, for example, and some of those other organizations that touch businesses. We also have a long list of community partners and small business partners, etc. So we can get that document, and actually rather than waiting for a request, I think what I'll do is just...
I'm going to ask on behalf of the House and the Senate that you go ahead and just provide that to the professional staff.
Okay. And if there are any groups that you think are not represented there, that would be a good forum or vehicle for us to make a touch point with, please feel free to let us know that, and we'll work through them.
Thank you. Ms. Parker, part of the role of chair is that of border collie, and I'm going to ask you to wrap up to keep us on time.
And that's perfect. I'm actually wrapping up. That's really the end. We'll bring that forward review and response document. We'll work through our stakeholder process. And the ultimate goal is at the end of July, we will have a set of recommendations that we make to the Joint Legislative Audit Committee, and that either this body or another legislative body move forward into the next session.
I think on behalf of both the House and the Senate, we have a very keen interest in watching your progress, and I would ask that you keep us both informed. And with that, I'm going to ask Mr. von Valkenburg to come forward as the chair of the commission. I thought it was particularly important that both committees see him today as the face of the volunteers who selflessly come forward to help advise the agency and be a reflection of their expertise and geographic location to help instruct the work of the commission and thereby the agency. So welcome, Mr. von Valkenburg.
Thank you, Chair Johnson and committee members. I promised that I wouldn't take it personally that the management team left as I moved up to the commission.
As a captain sticking with the crew, okay. Please continue.
For the record, as Senator Johnson indicated, I'm Wally Van Valkenburg. I'm a lawyer in Portland. I'm the chair of the Economic Community Development Commission. Thank you all for giving me an opportunity to make a few remarks here this afternoon. Senator Johnson requested that I make a few comments about the overall direction of OECDD and economic development generally in Oregon. Before I do that, I guess I should just point out that, as Senator Johnson pointed out, I am a volunteer. My remarks here don't necessarily reflect the views of the department, the governor's office.
Spoken like a judge lawyer.
In fact, I just met the gentleman to my left about an hour ago, and I have no idea whether he's going to agree with what I have to say, but I'm sure we'll get along just fine regardless. As I expect you know, the commission is a five-member board appointed by the governor to oversee OECDD. Board members are volunteers who come from around the state and from different business backgrounds. You have in your materials, I think, a list of the commission members, and we're pleased to have Senator Johnson and Representative Lim having been added as ex officio members, and we look forward to working with them on the commission. The commission is required by statute to do a few things having to do with allocations and the like, but frankly, most of our time is spent reviewing programs offered by the department, providing input to the department at a strategic level, and trying to reach out to businesses and communities around the state to seek input on what's important from an economic development standpoint. In terms of goals for the department and for the commission, I'd like to tackle that in two pieces, and my remarks are going to be brief. First, I'd like to talk briefly about what OECDD can reasonably expect to do for economic development as a state agency. And secondly, I'd like to talk about some of the challenges that I've seen in the 2 years that I've chaired the commission, actually about almost two and a half now, and what I think you as legislators and we as commission members ought to be doing about some of these challenges. First, what can OECDD do to promote economic development in Oregon? I think one of the things we constantly have to keep in mind is that it's the private sector that creates jobs and pushes the economy, and the role of the various economic development organizations on the public side is to facilitate that, not to create the jobs themselves. You've heard from Mike, and you saw in the materials a summary of some of the strategic objectives of the department. I find it helpful to divide what the department does into a few different buckets. In the first bucket, I place business recruiting, and this is more outward looking to companies that are perhaps doing business in other states. I include in that bucket our efforts to market the state, the branding efforts. Everyone knows about the efforts to change the image of Oregon as a place where we used to tell people to come visit but don't stay. Now we have, and I have a business card here that says our slogan is Oregon business, come for a week, stay forever. So we're trying to change the way the state's perceived. The recruiting efforts tend to produce some of the most visible results. That's what you see in the press release, the newspaper reports about a company locating from someplace else, moving their operations here. That's a very important part of what we do, but I would like to emphasize, I guess, that I think that it is no more important and in some ways less important than some of the other things we try to do that are more focused on what we already have. The second bucket, I would include efforts to work with existing Oregon industries to catalyze their own efforts to develop their own businesses and to bring the kind of economic activity that successful businesses bring. In this bucket, you could include some of the small business development efforts. I would also include the cluster development activities that you're going to hear a little bit about later this afternoon in more detail. But as I suspect you probably are aware, the department has been actively involved with various public and private partners to help develop a cluster strategy for Oregon, the cluster strategy being let's focus on what industries we already have where we have strong companies, because if those companies can grow and be successful, they tend to attract suppliers, customers, and spin off a lot of economic activity. The idea behind a successful cluster strategy is that companies are going to want to locate here because in order to be a player in a particular industry, you have to be in Oregon. And that, to me, is a longer-term investment, but it's a more lasting investment in some ways than trying to recruit companies to locate here where you're just competing with other states for how much money you can throw at the company to get them to locate here. In this bucket, I'd include some of the innovation initiatives that Mike referred to, and you'll hear more about the creation of ONAMI, the Oregon Nanoscience and Microtechnologies Institute, which involves an unprecedented collaboration between our three largest state higher education institutions and industry partners that is starting to generate the kind of research and development activities that we hope will ultimately lead Oregon to be a center for any company that wants to be a significant player in nanoscience. These are the kind of knowledge-based industries that I think will allow us as a state to pay to support the kind of wages that we need in order for our children and grandchildren to find this an attractive place to live in a world economy where we're increasingly competing not just with other states but with other countries. The legislature also last term authorized the creation of a commercialization of research fund that will be created by tax credits that will allow companies to move research from the university level into businesses. Those are the kinds of investments that I think we make in what we already have that are really key.
Yeah, Johnson.
Center.
The first couple of
issues that you address, do you have reports at all that address how many industries that we have been working with or have come into Oregon, as well as, I forget what the second thing was that you mentioned, but those are types of things I would really be interested in to see what your department is really doing.
Both on the recruiting and on the cluster development?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the answer is yes, and I'm going to look at my director.
We have heads nodding behind you, and again, I'm going to ask that information be made available to the professional staff and on to both committees.
A third bucket that I just identify is the what's been talked about is investment in infrastructure. A good example of that is the efforts the department has been making on industrial land certification, trying to identify areas where we are willing to place a bet that if it is prepared for industrial facilities, we'll get business to locate. There's one final bucket I'd like to identify that is a little bit more intangible, but I still think it's an important part of what the commission and the department do, and that's to try to be a sort of a liaison between state government and the business community, particularly some of the companies and traded sector industries that drive the long-term economic well-being of our state. Many of these companies have little regular contact with state government because the management team is too busy running the business. They're traveling all over the country and all over the world. I think it's important for the state through OECDD and through the commission to reach out to some of these companies to make sure that we understand what they see as the challenges and the opportunities for us as a state, and that's a part of what I feel like I am supposed to do as chair of the commission, and I think my fellow commissioners share that view.
Mr. Wilmot, the only thing I would add at that is to make sure that you reach out to all sizes of business. Apropos my good friend and colleague, Representative Smith, is concerned about mom and pops. I think for some of the small business folks, they're frustrated seeing the go-to guys be Intel, Nike, and just sometimes, you know, Mrs. Smith's Bakery gets overlooked, and I just hope there's a geographic spread and a employee number spread.
I think that's a fair point, Senator, and I think we certainly appreciate the fact that many of our, well, all of our big businesses in Oregon started out as small businesses at one time, and it's important for us to focus on them as well. I guess I'd like to turn now to some of the inhibitors, and I would say from my relatively brief tenure as commission chair that one of the agency's biggest challenges is frankly how to deal with the political issues that arise in economic development. OECDD is an economic development organization. It's supposed to focus on how we can get the best return on our investment of limited resources. We're a small state. We can compete for business and jobs, but we compete with larger, wealthier states as well as with other countries. And for us to be effective as an agency, as a state in this competition, we need to be smart, and we need to think hard about where we allocate our resources. Because resources are limited, this means there are going to be winners and losers in the process. The challenge is that OECDD is not just an economic development organization. It's also a public agency, and as you, as members of the legislature, know all too well, the push and pull of politics can sometimes make those decisions challenging to make. For example, how do we deal with the fact that there may be certain parts of the state where it doesn't make sense to have a large industrial site certified? I'm not suggesting that the only place you certify sites is in the Willamette Valley, and that's in fact not what we've done. And we have, I think, a pretty good track record of being responsive to communities around the state and not focusing on one state, one part of the state to the exclusion of others. But I just mentioned that because I think it's a challenge. And I think it's helpful for us to, as we present our issues to you, for you to be mindful of that.
May I put a finer point on that? And I don't expect you to have an answer. It may come up in the discussion as the afternoon moves on. But recently in the newspaper, there were some articles.
articles about an industry that does shipbreaking. They were particularly important to me because a number of spots in my district were being looked at. It seemed as though when the business came and made the presentation in the community for various and sundry reasons, the community said no thanks. It appeared in the newspaper articles, and of course I know they're accurate because they're in the newspaper, but it appeared that somewhere inside OECDD a decision had been made that this was an attractive industry for whatever reason that Oregon wanted to recruit. And my question is in several layers. First of all, as communities were saying no, when does the agency say we're going to back off and listen to what local government is saying? It appeared as though OECDD was staying in the hunt to recruit the company after some of the cities that were targeted for the possible location had peeled off. And so the other question is, at what point is the collective decision made that we want to attract a certain kind of industry? It seems to me that on a highly contrary, I see Mr. Salzgiver coming up here. It seems to me that on a, and I'm making no value judgment about whether or not shipbreaking is appropriate or good or could meet the environmental standards, but for some a recruitment of that controversial nature, I'm just trying to figure out, has the commission wrestled with the question of, is this the kind of industry that we want? Perhaps I hearken back, and I'm dating myself, to a time when Governor McCall made comments about Oregon out chasing every smokestack that existed. So where in the process does the decision occur that says, this is what we want, and we want it for these criteria, and these would be the sideboards against which a decision to locate will be made, in this instance specifically, meeting all the environmental standards and criteria that would make an undertaking like that appropriate?
I would like to respond, Chair Johnson, and then I'll on a more general level, and then I'll ask Mr. Salzgiver to respond specifically to the shipbreakers. I think it's interesting that we're talking about this example because normally the complaints I think we hear are that parts of the state are not getting enough focus in terms of that the companies are being recruited to larger metropolitan areas. This was an issue, I think, a situation where there was an effort to place a company in a community that, when it came down to it, a number of members of the community apparently didn't want it. I would say, and without any reference to the shipbreaking example specifically, that one of the challenges in economic development, I think, is that communities are not always of one mind in terms of what they want. I happen to live in a neighborhood in Portland where it's very difficult to get new businesses, new buildings built because the neighborhood likes the neighborhood the way it is. So I think in dealing with the issues that you're describing, we have to be mindful of the fact that sometimes there's going to be opposition to a business locating in a community, but the opposition may come from one segment and there may be another segment that likes it. But as far as the specific...
Before Mike can give more details of what went on in that, but I was just, for the committee's reference, I was at a meeting yesterday with Ray Knapp from the governor's office and a group of the other economic revitalization team directors that constitutes this group that we work in a kind of a holistic way when we're looking at issues, so we don't have people making mistakes or decisions based on not knowing all the issues that they should be faced with. And we didn't really come up with an answer to what went on, quite frankly. But what we did agree to, and I would support this, and maybe it might be a peculiar way to respond to your comment, Senator Johnson, but it is what it is. And we're going to try to use this as a learning opportunity, quite frankly. I don't know yet what has gone on. Mike and I have a list of things to ask Mike, and one of them we'll talk about with is what went on relative to the shipbreaking issue. But clearly there were issues that were apparent relative to some of the DEQ issues. Some of the issues that dealt with the potential exposure to the state of Oregon with the bacteria or things that could have a chilling effect on the natural environment. Generally, some people at the table that I was with yesterday didn't even know who was in charge of that until we found out that Department of Agriculture is a stakeholder in that. There were many, many stakeholders that should have been part of that discussion in its collective sense. How comments were made to present to the public or present to the newspaper that there seemed to be an inherent interest in this without thinking about what some of the other issues around the finality of the location of that business. I think that lost in the translation. It wasn't, I also would tell you that it appeared that there were a series of green lights going on. There was a willing property owner who was interested in doing this as a partnership. There was a company that was interested in doing it. Some information was garnered that would suggest that even the locals, to some degree, thought, hey, this is going to be a no-brainer. I guess they didn't really do a good job of assessing how the neighbors who were up on the hillside, who were looking down over this, how they had an opinion on it. So it was, I think, an aha moment for many of us. I'll take some guilt. I'm part of that economic revitalization team. I'm a housing guy. That was there, part of that team. And what role we should have been involved in pushing for that discussion is yet to be figured out yet. But, it's a bad example. I think it had a tendency to tarnish what good things can come about working with economic and working with the state agencies. And we've got to capture the moment to figure out what went wrong so we don't duplicate that. Because we can't afford to have those kind of moments that are played out in the press that makes the state and the state system look like they're not incapable of either introducing or producing business opportunities in communities.
Thank you. Senator Morris Anderson,
yes.
And then Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair. This brings up, I think, a really important issue regarding the various agencies that we have, like the Department of Ag and their interests, and LCDC also, and what they have done. I would really like to get some recommendations from you regarding, for instance, one of my treks. I've had a couple of treks to Eastern Oregon, and there was some land, and it's secondary land, but still, they wanted to get a waiver to have an industry there. Well, SCDC wouldn't do it. Yet I felt that if OECDD had gotten involved, that they possibly would have seen the economic benefits and all that sagebrush, and it was type two, why the waiver couldn't have happened. And these are things I think that, especially with by major settlement the way it did, is the struggles that especially Eastern Oregon or rural Oregon has, that we've got to look at our land use too. So I don't know how much interaction you have with LCDC in regarding those issues.
Madam Chair, Senator, obviously the configuration of the Economic Revitalization Team, LCDC, is one of those primary of those seven partners. I was also at a discussion just recently where we think strongly that the big look that's going to be taken underway by LCDC here to look about what's going on in land use laws here for the next 20 or 30 years, it's a role that economic development should be part of some of that discussion, because their decisions and those visions that they're going to have can have both a positive effect, but also could have a very chilling effect on the ability of an agency who's trying to produce business opportunities if there isn't some kind of choreographing of those feelings about how this big look should be addressing issues on industrial lands and things like that. So you're right. I think there should be more connectivity. I think the agency, the core agencies are together. I can't explain to you why this one kind of slipped between the cracks. It doesn't do any of us who were at the table yesterday with Ray Naft to have the discussion about this, because this is nothing that any of us would ever want to have happen. This is the least positive thing you could ever have as a director of an organization that sits at the table with other agencies who have a standing principle is that we are there to solve problems and not make solutions happen, not create problems. And in fact, we have created a problem. And I think that goes contradictory to what we really want to accomplish.
Representative Smith, Representative Tomei, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. Very quickly, as I look at the three of you up there, I want to point out you have a real opportunity in front of you. You're actually the first director in three terms for me.
Thanks.
But this is the first time, and Mike and I have talked about this, this is the first time I've seen the legislative branch on board with the executive branch, on board with your department. And I would hope that we take this opportunity and really run with it, because you really do have a tremendous moment in front of you to really move the state forward. Quick question for you. And I don't expect an answer, but I'd love to have someone share their thoughts with me at some point in time. Who decided that growth was good for the state of Oregon? who decided that growth enhances quality of life? I remember being 12 years old growing up in Gresham, picking strawberries. Today it's a movie theater. I'm just curious, who in the state of Oregon decided that we needed to grow and bring business and industry into the state, grow our population, and consequently the quality of life was going to be increased? The capable professional staff has captured that as a question.
I don't mean to make light of it. I think it's a very valid question. Parts of the state crying out for growth, other parts saying enough, and quality of life is degraded by congestion and inability to site any more industry. I think it's a completely legitimate question that the two committees can wrestle with through the course of the interim, and it's something that I think the legislature may want to come back and revisit with both the agency seeing the commission again.
Well, I'd just like to say, as one of the people to whom the question was directed, that I think it's a legitimate question too, but I think that it's probably something that we need to have a more fulsome discussion on than I think the chair is going to allow us to have here today. But I'd like to have that conversation.
Yeah. And all joking aside, I'm going to ask Jim to capture that. Yep. Representative Tomei.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, I think this may have been the first time we're on the same wavelength. I'm thinking along the same lines as you.
Yeah, right this year.
Because I was thinking the same thing, Mr. Van Valkenburg. When you were talking about your first, I would assume that your priority was to recruit business, and I thought the same thing. I'm hearing from the business leaders in my community. They're asking why we don't provide 1,000 jobs for 1,000 different small businesses rather than bringing in an outside business that will have 1,000 jobs that will also bring new people into the state, which creates more growth in the state. But when that business moves out again, then we've lost those 1,000 jobs. Whereas we put 1,000 more workers in 1,000 businesses, then we have people who are already living in Oregon who can be working. So I think I'm on the same page as you.
Representative Tomei, I would just like to say that I agree with that strategy to the extent that we are better off with homegrown companies and companies that grow over time here with Oregon roots than we are attracting a company that might just be looking for the cheapest place to do business and then move on as soon as they can find a still cheaper place. And I think that is one of the focuses of the department and the commission. One of the things that we want to focus on is not just the number of jobs created, but the quality of the jobs and what those jobs pay, being the best place in North America to have a Walmart, for example, isn't really the strategic goal here.
Mr. Saltzgiver has a comment, then Representative Lim, and then we're done.
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I'm going to try to hit two balls with one bat here. To the question of shipbreaking, first of all, we are going through an internal and interagency level, beginning that discussion of kind of a postmortem. I will say from my perspective, though, and we will provide you with a report of what we found in our deliberations and do a postmortem report for you. From my perspective, I will say I think the process actually worked the way it was supposed to work. The public meetings that were held in Newport were done. Well, first of all, we are contacted regularly by businesses who are interested in investing in Oregon, and I'm pleased to say that in the last year and a half, that number has almost quadrupled in size. So the recovery is underway. That's good news. We tend to be rather community-driven when we do this, so our business development officers are contacted, or one of us is contacted. We devolve them back to the BDOs, and we work with community partners, with members of the Community Development Forum, AOC, Association of Oregon Counties, League of Oregon Cities, the ports, the service districts, and others to vet these things. So there's a broad array of discussion that already occurs. Second, I would say that at the end of the day, back to the Newport thing, there was strong feedback from the local project sponsors, the port and the city of Newport in particular, that there was an interest in having that business come there. And in doing our due diligence, they passed the review that we expect to have in terms of
from the agency's mission of creating jobs and creating a business climate, they passed the first filter of tests. Now, as you got into the public comment period, which we requested, I might add, we saw that the community in total chose not to have that investment there. That's the way the process is supposed to work. We will provide you, however, with a referral report when the postmortem is complete. And I will say that we are looking for an even more active interagency and internal discussion process as business development matures.
Thank you, Representative Lim.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, thank you very much for the testimony, especially the goal the OECD and a commission is to business recruiting. My question is, while we are recruiting, are we retaining the business what we have in our state? And we are trying to catch a rabbit in the field while losing the home rabbit. And we don't want to do that. I'm just interested to find out, while we are recruiting, how many businesses we lost in the past 2-3 years, because I know some of the companies left our state. Some national streamlining, the worldwide competition, maybe there might be other reasons, but I'd like to find out how many coming in, how many are they moving out. If they are moving out and why, we need to identify those problems, make sure in the future let them stay in our state by all means if possible.
Chair Johnson, Representative Lim, I will tell you that as far as in day-to-day operations, if you keep any set of letters in mind, keep in mind RETR. In order, in priority order, that means retention, expansion, transition, and recruitment. That's really what our business development team does, is focus on retention first, then expansion of existing businesses, transition assistance where businesses are changing, we will provide that, and recruitment. Now, those are happening concurrently. They're happening all at once, but that is the priority, and if we have to make a choice between the marginal use of one unit of energy, having to choose between retention and recruitment, we're going to choose retention. That's where we'll focus our energy.
Concluding comment, Mr. Valkenberg.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. I appreciate the opportunity to make one more observation, and then I will retreat. We had a commission meeting at Corvallis a couple of weeks ago, and I want to express my appreciation for Representative Holvey, who attended part of that meeting. There was a discussion that I wanted to just pass on to this committee, and it's probably a little bit beyond the scope of what we're here today to talk about, but if you'll just indulge me, we were hosted by Hewlett-Packard in Corvallis, which, as I think everyone knows, is a very important corporate citizen in Corvallis, and we had a great presentation on the history of HP in Oregon. At the end of the presentation, I asked the representative from Hewlett-Packard how she thought Oregon was stacking up compared to other places that HP does business, and she hesitated for a moment, and then she said, well, I'm not really authorized to speak on behalf of the company on this, but she said, but just speaking for myself, I would say we are increasingly having difficulty recruiting the kind of people we need to Corvallis because of the challenges we have with our public education system and because of the challenges we have with our tax system. This is something that everyone is aware of. I feel like it's incumbent upon me, as we're talking about big economic development issues, to at least put on the table the fact that these are increasingly, as we go around the state and talk to business people, some of the inhibitors we have to economic development. It's not really the charge of the commission or the department, but I will say that I think the conventional wisdom is that we don't have the will to do things, anything about this. When I talk to people around the state in both the business community and in the community at large, I think we may sell ourselves a little short. I think if we can tackle those challenges in an effective way, private sector, business community, other interest groups, and elected leaders like yourselves, with all the other things that we're doing right for economic development, I think we have a great future ahead of us. Thank you for letting me make some remarks.
Thank you very much. I'm going to conclude this panel by acknowledging how extremely helpful Mr. Salzgiver has been in his role as interim. He has done an extraordinary job. He's been accessible and available, and I thank him for that. I also want to acknowledge Lynn Beaton, who has accepted a new portfolio portfolio of responsibilities in the agency and has undertaken those with great zeal. Thank you very much for coming. I'm going to exercise the prerogative of the chair and change the order slightly. We're going to invite Mr. Duncan Wise to come up and talk about the Oregon Business Council. This panel has set up the discussion of clusters and industrial lands, and so, Mr. McCabe, I'm putting you on notice that you're going to come up in the batting order. You'll follow the cluster presentation, if that's okay with you.
Fine.
Okay?
Madam Chair, members of the committee. I
don't know what I said. Good afternoon, Mr. Wise.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Duncan Wise. I'm president of the Oregon Business Council. It's really a pleasure to be here with this joint committee of both houses. I really want to stress how grateful I am for that, this opportunity. It's been a real pleasure just listening to all of you and your comments and the different points of view you bring, and really your conversation reminds me why I agree so much with Representative Lim of the need for a joint committee on economic development for the state. I remember the days when we had it and the difference it made. I will tell you that the topics you're dealing with are among the most complicated policy issues you will engage in, because you're talking about something as complicated as an economy that really touches every part of state government's business. And with 90 legislators all with views on this and other outside folks trying to put their pressure on this department, which is a relatively small part of the economy, but a very critical part, what happens is it gets tugged and pulled in a lot of different directions. And what I recall, and it wasn't perfect when there was a joint committee that thought about this day in, day out, with professional staff thinking about it day in, day out, and bringing the recommendations, is that there was more focus on what the goals are for economic development, how you deal with the trade-off, quality of life and growth and all the issues you're talking about. And there was clarity about the specific role the department could play, and the understanding that the department's role changes over time in different parts as the economy changes and we go through different periods of our economic life. And what I will tell you about the department, and I know we were asked to talk about our relationships with the department, and I'll come to that in a moment, but I've watched the department for years. I was part of it for a while, and I've watched it for an even longer period. And when the department is focused and on mission, it is the most amazing organization you will find. It's an absolutely spectacular organization. It's great people. I've had great experiences with it in the last 3 years I can talk with you about. The challenge the department has, and all of us who look at it and care about it will tell you, is when they've got too many chiefs pushing it in too many directions, it's very hard to manage. And so, and you're the biggest chiefs of all, in a sense, and so your focus and your energy really becomes important. And so the second reason I'm really grateful is the fact that Senator Johnson, that you're eager to look at the statutes and really take a fresh look at the code that's developed, because I think that will help clarify the policy issues that you're dealing with. So with that in mind, I guess I'd just like to touch on a couple things. First of all, what we're doing with the Oregon Business Plan, first of all, and then the role the department plays. I think the chair asked me to talk about the relationship with the department and the Oregon Business Plan. Just briefly to answer the question of the department and the business plan, we've been engaged together from the beginning. Both the chair of the Economic Development Commission and the director have been on the steering committee for the business plan, and they've been great partners all along. I'll come back to that in just a minute. But first, let me talk about the business plan and what it is. And its relation to the department. When I think it's fair to say that in the 1990s we all got kind of fat and happy around the economy in a lot of the state. The economy was going really well, and it's hard to remember those days, but it was going so well that we really just put it in lots of parts of the state, not every part, not in some of the rural communities, but in a lot of the state we just basically sort of forgot about it. And I think it's fair to say in the business community, we were all doing different pieces of work, but the business community as a whole wasn't particularly focused on economic strategy, economic growth. Everybody was too busy going out and selling products. And when the recession hit, we took a pretty deep look at ourselves as a business community and asked, are we providing the direction from a business community on what we think is important to work on as a state to build the economy? Do we have clarity about what our goals are? Do we have a shared agenda? And is it something we can communicate with our elected leaders about? And we concluded we weren't. And so the Business Council, which I'm the executive, asked me to work with my other business organizations to develop a statewide strategy for economic growth. It became known as the Oregon Business Plan. And I want to stress that the Oregon Business Plan is not the Oregon Business Council's plan. The steering committee that oversees the Oregon Business Plan includes the chairs of the major associations, chair of the Small Business Council, many of the key board members on key state commissions, and it includes, of course, the chair of the Economic Development Commission and the director of Economic Development. And that group works collaboratively to develop what is the Oregon Business Plan, and has from the beginning. The Oregon Business Plan focuses on the big policy issues you were talking about earlier. What are our goals fundamentally? What are we trying to accomplish for the economy as we look ahead? Our view on the goals is what we took from the Progress Board, is that it's more higher quality jobs for Oregonians. It's not necessarily more jobs, but it's higher quality, higher wage jobs for Oregonians in every part of the state. And that goal needs to be nested with the other goals of quality of life and natural healthy surroundings. And that's the fundamental vision that we ascribe to. To achieve that the goal of higher wage jobs, we think you need to focus on what we call traded sector economy, the part of the economy, about a third of the jobs that sell their products and services outside our borders. It's the forestry industry, it's the ag industry, it's high technology, it's metals, it's tourism. It's those parts of the economy that bring in fresh dollars, which then wind their way into the rest of the economy to pay for our schools, to pay for local retail services, the rest of the jobs. And we think it's really important as a starting point to understand that is the source of prosperity. That is where we find the vitality for our state. We must, as a state, when we think about economic policy, economic strategy, stay focused on those industries that are bringing in the fresh dollar. As we focus on those industries, we conclude that those industries don't cite themselves randomly here. They form what we call concentrations or clusters. We see concentrations in agriculture. We see concentrations in forestry and in various high-tech clusters. And they're here for a reason. They're here. They're strong here for a reason. And we need to understand why they're here, what their challenges are, and what they need to be successful going forward. And so in the Oregon Business Plan, we spent a great deal of time going around the state talking with industry leaders in their clusters about what their challenges are and what they're doing. As we did that, I would stress, we did that with the Economic Development Department. When we went around the state, then it was Katie Koba went around with me, and again, when Marty Patley came in, he was a participant in a lot of this as well, and of course Mike as well has been a great partner. So we've done this jointly, but learning what the industry needs are and trying as much as possible to focus on those specific clusters. As we listen to them all, they all basically have the same story to tell about the challenges they're facing in globalization that the Representative Bloom talked about. It's a tough, tough world in the global economy, and they're all fighting this challenge of globalization and global competition. And in every cluster we listen to, they all basically had the same message, that to be competitive in this environment, those firms had to be at the leading position in their fields. They couldn't make it as being a standard commodity producer against China or India or those other places. They had to be doing something that was more innovative, higher end, either in production processes or coming up with new products. And again, it was consistent wherever we went. Our favorite, of course, was out in your way, Senator Nelson, was Oregon Country Beef, which is now Northwest Country Beef, where they found a way to specialize and add value to their product and do the business better. So we think that the vision for the economy that we need to work on together is the idea of looking at our clusters and helping them be at the top of the game globally in competing. So that's the vision. And if we hold that vision, then everything else we think will follow in terms of strategy and delivery. I see a question from Representative Smith.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. If we buy into that premise, what do we tell those communities who don't have those clusters?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I think what we found is those do exist and can exist in virtually any part of the state. We don't think clusters are unique to certainly urban areas. We're seeing some really, I use Oregon Country Beef as an example.
Let me follow up.
Yeah.
Representative Smith, let's take, it's not in my district, but pretty familiar with it. Let's take Wheeler County.
Sure.
1,500 people, couldn't even tell you what a cluster is.
Yeah, well,
how do they benefit?
Well, I think, Madam Chair, I think that Wheeler County would know what a trade sector company was. You know, whether you call it a cluster, but agriculture is probably, and ranching and forestry, which have been mainstays for years, are the source historically of jobs in much of rural Oregon, and they still will be, and I think we still have major opportunities to grow those economies based on those sectors, the trade sector. Now the question is obviously in each of those sectors, what can we do to make them more competitive?
Just push back. I just want to push back. Wheeler County doesn't manufacture anything. How do they benefit?
I would stress manufacturing is not the definition of a traded sector cluster. Tourism is a traded sector. Agriculture production is a traded sector. Growing trees is a traded sector. Ranching is a traded sector. All of those are products that bring in fresh dollars to the state by being sold outside the border. So
one more follow-up.
Just last thought.
And I'm pushing back, not meaning to be belligerent, just to push back, representing rural Oregon. I think there needs to be some outreach into rural Oregon to better understand the role of this, because I can assure you rural Oregon doesn't understand the role of the Oregon Business Plan. I can assure you they don't.
Madam Chair, and I know we have outreach to do in many parts of the state on explaining, but I think what we've tried to do through our illustrations is explain that, in fact, the principles apply. We spent a lot of time out in rural Oregon, actually, in terms of listening, and what we found is the same principles do apply broadly. I mean, obviously, the way it takes place in terms of individual strategies vary widely. I mean, there are different locations because different industries have different needs, but the basic positioning, we believe, as we look and listened, is pretty similar. There's more similarity in our state than I think we understand if we really listen hard. And again, I'm not saying we've done enough. I've spent a lot of time in rural Oregon listening. And again, I think if you look at some of the strategies that are emerging, for example, in forestry and agriculture, I think they speak very much to what we need to do in rural Oregon. And again, if you look at the business plan, particularly, again, we can talk more, and if there's other things we need to be doing, I'm more than open. But the point I'm making is, and I think it's a fairly fundamental economic point, is wealth comes from trade. The wealth does not come from that's where you draw new dollars, which help support the economy. The best example I can give of the point is, you just go visit a rural town where a mill is closed. You understand immediately the importance of the traded sector, because everything else withers upon the closure of the mill unless there's something to take its place. And so we all have, whether we understand it or not, a great dependence on those firms that are bringing in the fresh dollars. And we often don't see it, but it's right.
I want to help you, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's why I'm pushing back. Mm-hmm. I can assure you, your 10 most eastern Oregon counties do not understand the role of the Oregon Business Plan.
I just want to make that clear. And I hear you. And again, I'd really welcome a way to help to improve that.
I apologize for having to step out for just a moment. One other thing that might be useful is, to the degree that the agency is going through a statutory review, and those statutes are the legislature's instruction to the agency, it might be useful, and I don't want to create another superstructure or process, but it might be useful to see how what's left syncs up with the business plan. Mm-hmm. To the degree that we're off in two different directions, I'm not sure how useful that is, but at least somebody take a cursory look at what we're recommending to be implemented in law in the 2007 session and how that syncs with your current iteration of the business plan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We welcome that opportunity, and again, we work pretty closely, so I think we can do that. So finally, again, just to the business plan, I'm not going to go through in any detail on the rest, but the point, the business plan, we have a vision for the economy, then we have broad strategies for supporting that vision, and the only point in that, we call it the four P's, people, place, productivity, and pioneering innovation. The only point I would make about the broad strategies is that they cover really everything. When you talk about the economy, you have to talk about education, you have to talk about roads and bridges, you have to talk about rail infrastructure, you have to talk about
the resources that really touch most state agencies and a lot of local agencies, and it's got to be a comprehensive view. And frankly, the Department of Economic Development can't deal with all those issues, water being a good example. Senator Nelson, it may be something that the department wants to take on, but the water issue is obviously broader than that one department in dealing with a whole variety of fundamental policy issues. If we're going to drive the economy forward, we have to tackle those big policy issues. And one of the challenges we face when we talk about economic development policy is some of those challenges land in the department's lap. But frankly, for you as policymakers, you need to understand some of these don't and do the kind of direction some of you were talking about earlier, saying other departments need to deal with these. That's what we've tried to do in the business plan. We have a set of initiatives that support the broad strategy, some of which relate to the department, some of which relate to education, some relate to transportation. And the way we think about it as a business community is we need to touch all those areas and set goals in each of those areas for building the economy.
Duncan, beyond the actual summit, and I think some of us have had the opportunity to go to the summit, how far down are you driving formalizing the business plan? What I'm thinking of is that the congressional delegation periodically reaches out to the state and certainly to all of us, and they say we're putting together our prioritization list for federal funding, what may still exist. I would ask, and I'll ask Mr. MacArthur when he comes up and speaks on behalf of the counties, to say, have you made a presentation to AOC? Is there a general subscription to the plan across Oregon beyond those folks that show up, listen to the presentations at the summit, participate in the breakout groups, and go home?
Well, Madam Chair, we work hard at this, and again, I think as Representative Smith, I don't think we've done it fully enough. I mean, our goal is to build a unified plan, and you know, I don't pretend in 4 years we have done that entirely, but we are. That is, the goal is to have an outreach strategy that brings in more and more folks into the plan. In terms of what we do beyond the summit, the work goes on really between the summits. We have identified initiatives. This year we have 9 of them, and those initiatives all have business leaders assigned to work with public partners and others to work on them, and we keep very close track of how we're doing on those initiatives through our initiative tracker. We tracked the legislature. Last time you hit, I think it was 11.5 out of 13 we proposed. You missed on Brand Oregon and a couple others, but you did a really good job on a lot of different areas. We track the congressional delegation. The congressional delegation looks at our initiative guide. They say these are the ones we want to work on. We write them down, and we check them off and see whether they're happening. We also work with the Economic Development Department. They've had a number of areas that relate to the Oregon business plan. The industrial lands was in the original Oregon business plan. We had a program to refocus the Oregon economic development in the original Oregon business plan, and that, you know, in the speaker's document that was produced, a lot of it drew right out of the business plan, and that got done in that first legislative session. So a lot of this work goes on day in and day out, and we track it with our initiative tracker and broadcast the results to our web list.
On behalf of both of the committees, would you mind getting the summary of those initiatives to the professional staff?
Yeah, we have a box. I brought a box. A lot of you have. This is just the material from the summit, so I didn't want to get a lot of you were there, but I have a whole box. If you want to just pass it.
And then Representative Tomei has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Duncan, I was at the summit, and I think I've been at every summit, and I think at every summit, one of the concerns that we hear about in business is we need an educated workforce, and education is so important. Mm-hmm. And this summit, I was disappointed. I expected someone to say, we need to give back the business kicker, and I didn't hear that from anyone, and I was disappointed at that.
I really noted that the public finance side wasn't, we didn't present our goal. We do have public finance recommendations in the business plan. We've said, if we want to take a look at tax policy, last session we weren't involved particularly in the tax policy because frankly we didn't understand that there was going to be much of a discussion. If there is going to be a discussion on tax policy in the upcoming session, we're preparing ourselves for that discussion. Our basic view on education and public finance, I would stress, is one, it's absolutely critical to have a well-educated populace, and then a lot of changes in the education delivery which will improve it. In terms of financing education, while we do need to look at tax policy,
LLC, and as Wally Dunbar-Kenberg says, I think a lot of the business community think there's some real challenges with our tax structure as we have it. The best way, at least in the near term, we see to raise more money for schools is to keep the economy growing, and it's going to be about $1.2 billion next time, and we hope even more the time after. And if we can invest in those dollars into schools and in targeted investments, we think we can make a lot of difference in education. You can, again, still think we can have a conversation about tax policy, but let's not forget the prize. If we keep this economy growing, one feature of this tax structure, which we're not particularly thrilled with, is it's very elastic. That is, as the economy grows with a personal income, we draw a lot more money, and we're on a growth curve right now, and let's think carefully about how to save a little bit for the next rainy day, but also how to invest it wisely in education, because we think there's going to be some big opportunity here.
Senator Nelson will be the concluding question.
Thank you, and thank you, Duncan. For the committee's information, I'm going to put it before a committee on alternative fuels on Monday, I believe.
Yes.
It was quite an interesting committee because there was representing from the Nature Conservancy, environmental group, Duncan's group, Oregon Forest Resource
Institute,
you had Department of Forestry, and also Oregon State University, basically talking about the same issue in some respects. The fact is that I think there's a recognition among a lot of interest groups, which you're part of, that we're going to do things differently in the state of Oregon. And going to Representative Dormier's issue, if you look at the our ability to fund education, or the amount of money we're putting into education, basically started declining in 1991. Now, people could say it might be Major 5, but it's also, that was the decline of our timber industry. We took one of our major industries and destroyed it. And now, in the irony of this whole thing is, now in the name of energy and power and alternative fuels, we're going to build it back up again. And our schools have heard of this 15 years, and I think we have to be a little smarter on that. I don't know if you want to comment on the connection between what you're doing with the little biomass.
Yep. Madam Chair, and actually I'll use that as a way, because I know you want me to close, but I think I wanted to leave you with one more point. And I want to just give you the history of how we came to the decision to advocate for the woody biomass. One of the things we've done in the business plan this year with Wally Dunbar-Kenberg and I, which together have built this, what we call the Oregon Cluster Network, where we've invited the clusters to come in and give us detailed plans of what they need to make them more competitive and successful in the global economy. And they presented their findings at the summit, where you have the report, the cluster resource guide, where we've gotten detailed information from our industry leaders on what they need. In the case of forestry, we're really excited about the opportunity in forestry in Oregon. We have a great chance to grow this industry as we look ahead. One of the opportunities they identified was woody biomass. If we can use that as an opportunity, we have the opportunity for a triple win to grow rural economies, to create energy from trees, from thinning, and to create jobs, and sort of renewable energy, healthy forests, and rural economic growth, and out of that growth, revenue for the statewide economy. That was identified out of the forest cluster that Alan Ford from Roseburg Forest Products led. We brought in the Nature Conservancy to talk with us about their perspective and came up with this opportunity, which we presented to you. And this is one of the priorities in the Oregon Business Plan for this year. I suspect we'll bring back some more recommendations to you in the next legislative session. We're certainly going to be working with the federal delegation to work on federal forest policies and then we'll wait to the PUC. So by bringing the cluster together, identifying an opportunity, and then connecting the dots across a whole different variety of institutional interests, we think we can make a big difference. And I would only say that Senator Nelson identified this opportunity before we did and passed legislation last session to promote this. But again, concurrently, we reached the same conclusion. And again, we want to help bridge this opportunity and make it happen for Oregon.
Thank you very much for taking your time to come down. I think given the high-level nature of this very aggressive agenda, you have at least stimulated some thought among both committees, and we may call on your expertise again as we move forward.
I'm really happy to do that. And again, I just want to stress we've really enjoyed the partnership with the department. They've done a great job as we've worked together. They've been with us, and I really appreciate that.
Thank you very much. Mr. Fox, please, and anybody else from your industry that is presenting, and by way of administrative reminders, any of the public that wish to testify, please sign up on the sign-up sheet at the gate or at the door coming in.
Thank you. Chairman Johnson and members of the committee, let me introduce myself. I'm Ron Fox. I'm the division manager for the trade, for the, excuse me, for the business and trade development division that Mike Salzgiver spoke of earlier. I think we can cover just a little bit of detail on the department's initiatives around the industrial cluster strategies that, that Duncan alluded to. I wanted to introduce Amy Kider, who is our, well, I'm not going to use the term that she uses to describe her position. We call her our industrial cluster coordinator. She has another term that she could decide if she wants to share that with you. But we have been working closely with the Oregon Business Council and other members of Oregon's economic and industry groups for well over 3 years in developing the kind of output that I think Duncan alluded to that was presented at the Business Summit in January. In those presentations, I think if you look closely, you will see that there is work underway and among a number of clusters to address issues like the forest products sector that address the opportunity for a different way of utilizing the forest mass that exists in Oregon. It's a different way of looking at that resource than we have done in the past. Amy specifically has been very closely associated with work in the display and imaging cluster, and I've been involved quite closely with an initiative around the manufacturing workforce strategy that's an effort that the governor has been leading specifically and was addressed there. So we are now assuming again the leadership for the Oregon Oregon Industrial Network Group that has been being led by a staff member at OBC, but that is now coming back into the agency. That will be one of many of Amy's responsibilities, and we expect and plan to continue to put a great deal of energy into doing just what Duncan said, helping our important industry groups be competitive in the global marketplace, addressing issues that affect their competitive stature and their ability to perform and compete in the global marketplace. So with that, I'll let Amy add a few comments, and then we can answer any questions that might arise.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kider.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Amy Kider, and my emails do identify me as the cluster queen in Oregon. So I just wanted to take a couple of minutes and maybe give you a cluster 101, very, very high level. Why do we care and what are clusters? And I can probably do this at the speed of light.
Good.
And, blasting through this, we've already touched on traded sectors, and clusters are nothing new. If you think about ancient Italy, or you still buy Italian shoes because they have a reputation for being the best shoes, that started back with the guilds back in, you know, the Renaissance, the little tiny Italian town that makes all the shoes, that's a cluster. We're doing the same thing. Oddly enough, Portland is famous for its shoes. There was just an article in the Oregonian front page about Keen shoes coming to Portland, and it said, if you want to design great shoes, you're located in Portland. That's the power of clusters. That's why we're working on cluster development. Okay, so the idea is nothing new. It's an approach that we think makes a lot of sense. I hope you're all beer drinkers. Microbrews are a great example of clusters in Oregon. Because it's not just the rivalry, it's not just the fact that we have a lot of them there. We also have the suppliers, we have the purchasers, and we have the inputs, the natural resources, the hops, whatever it is that it takes to build the cluster. I think the thing that people need to understand about clusters is there are lots of industries in Oregon that have trade associations. Trade associations are not clusters, but what can make them clusters are people like me. Senator Johnson just left. She and I have something in common. She says she's a border collie, and I consider myself an Australian cattle dog. My job is to nip at everybody's heels and say, you guys, this is what you said you want to do. Now, let me kind of bark at you and get you all shepherded and going in the same direction. Part of taking a trade association and moving it into a cluster is looking at this pyramid that I have, and you've got the leading firms, but you also have the suppliers, and that touches on Senator Smith's point about what are those ranchers agriculture guys out in eastern Oregon doing. They're suppliers into these clusters. And then you've got the economic foundations, and one of the critical pieces of a cluster is the underpinnings, the workforce, and the ties to the universities. Okay, that's critical. That's where the research and development is happening a great deal that's going to help grow these industries. And so it's We need to be able to move the industry associations, the trade associations, and bring in the underpinnings, the supplier firms and the foundations, the economic foundations, the infrastructure foundations that bring all the pieces together, and then get everybody aligned and say, these are our goals, this is what we want to accomplish, these are the top three priorities for our industry. We've got the suppliers, we've got the leading firms, and then we've got the underpinnings. That's the critical part of cluster development.
From the Representative Abakan, like that.
I'm sorry.
Question.
Okay.
You mentioned the university system, which has prompted the thought in my head. You consider government entities to be part of the cluster.
Senator Johnson and Representative Abakan, yes, we do. That's actually many of our the pieces at the bottom of that pyramid that are the foundations, the infrastructure, are other government agencies, they're public-private partnerships. They're whoever the industry needs to help them succeed, whatever the cluster needs. But yes, government is certainly part of that. And part of our job, and part of my job as the cluster queen, is to try and bring in all the right players and really nip at their heels and get them all in the same room and say, oh, we have this ability, oh, we have this program, oh, you know, I might know somebody who can help you bring whatever it is to fruition. I want to kind of blast, as I said, I wanted to blast through. The next map has some of the high-tech clusters around the nation. You've seen the ecology of the Silicon Forest. That is clusters in action. And now I want to take a second to talk about some of the specific work that I've been doing and why I'm now the cluster queen. I've convened cluster roundtables in three different industries at this point. One is what we've called the values differentiated food cluster. That's a very non-accessible term, but it's working from the consumer backwards and saying, what is the consumer? Why is the consumer buying this particular product? And it's based on their values, which might be artisan manufactured, organic, natural, locally produced. So go ahead, Senator Smith. I'm sorry, it seemed like you had a question.
That gets to be my
job. Excuse me, I'm sorry. Representative Smith.
Sorry, I waited a long time for the gavel.
By the way, he just thinks he's a senator.
Representative Smith, I appreciate the promotion, but how does this differ from the work that our small business development centers are doing?
Chairman Johnson, Representative Smith, I don't think it's differentiated per se. I think what it is part of the small business development centers are very much engaged with the small emerging businesses that make up Oregon's economy. Out of that, all those businesses, the small business development centers work with a substantial portion of those businesses are some of the cluster firms themselves, but many of them are key suppliers that supply essential components to the primary industries here in Oregon. And it's that relationship that we think provides that multiplier effect for Oregon's economy. I know in talking with the SBDC center directors, they work with a lot of companies who supply goods and services to major companies or major organizations, and that's a lifeblood of their individual organizations. So that pyramid that Amy referred to, I think particularly the upper two boxes of that pyramid, which really represent the private sector players in the overall economy, the lower component can be both private sector, but as Representative Hayden mentioned, it also includes many of the government organizations, from education to institutional organizations that deal with competitive challenges and barriers of businesses.
Just to follow up, I just might encourage as you continue to develop the cluster form of economic development, that you allow your small business partners to play a key role and be at the table, because they're the front line in perhaps making referrals, perhaps working with lenders, perhaps working with these suppliers. And I just want to make sure that partnership is
is solidified.
Duly noted, Representative Benson.
Thank you.
Go ahead. I would like to just finish up by talking about a little bit, giving a sense of some of the success or what can happen with a cluster. As I said, I coordinated a specialty food cluster, which brought in representatives from all over the state, including Grants Pass, our friends from Oregon Country Beef, and the Eugene area was certainly represented at that roundtable. I did another one in bioscience, focused primarily in the Portland metro area, I will admit. And then the display industry is one that that's received the most press. And the display industry is one that I can talk about some real successes. Oregon really is a center of excellence in a very technical area, a subsection of our high technology community. It's in displays. We are a center of excellence around the United States, if not the world. We brought these people together. They are working. We meet on a quarterly basis. They have identified very specific goals, and we are actively having success against their goals. They want to attract capital investment. They want to have raise their profile as a center of excellence in the display industry, so it's a lot. There's some PR involved with it, and they also want to reach into higher education so that we can grow our own optical engineers, because there is no program right now for optical engineering in our university system. So they want to grow their own optical engineers, and they want to create something called a compatibility testing lab, and that's becoming a reality at Portland State University. So there are some things that we've had real success with. I'm not trying to steal Debbie Kennedy's thunder, but I did want to show, I saw you folks looking at this. This is a piece of a handout for a trade show in the display industry that came to Oregon specifically because we've been promoting the display cluster, and they said, my God, there's really a center of excellence there. And this trade show came to Portland in October, and on the back was a message from the governor and a little map showing some of the companies that make up this cluster around the state of Oregon. And on the inside is some of the efforts of Brand Oregon that Debbie Kennedy is going to be touching on in her presentation.
Thank you. That is a perfect segue into moving to Mr. McCabe and then Ms. Kennedy. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you for coming to visit with us today.
You bet. For the record, I'm Tim McCabe, Manager of Economic Development. I'm going to be quick here, too. For Pacific Power, and Senator Johnson has asked me to come here to talk about the certified site program from a private sector perspective. And the reason I'm qualified to do this is for the past 6 years I've had the good fortune to work with the department and individuals within the department and to watch this program evolve. So to give you a little history on the certified site program, at the end of 2000 and well into 2001, you may remember that California was experiencing a deregulation energy crisis. And when this was happening during this period and the ensuing year, the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department was inundated with calls from businesses in Northern California looking to relocate to Oregon. This increased activity caused two issues to become readily noticeable. Because of the prosperity in the 90s, it was very difficult to identify available industrial properties that met the customer needs. And secondly, obtaining the proper permits within the state could take as long as 2 years. These two problems, coupled with others, caused the department to miss out on numerous opportunities. These missed opportunities prompted the department to look for ways to address these problems, and after researching the problems, the department suggested the creation of a certified project ready site program. Unfortunately, at that time, there was no funds available to fund this initiative. Fortunately, when Governor Kulongoski took office, he recognized the need for such a program, and the department partnered with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Association to identify potential sites and create an industrial lands database. On May 3, 2004, the governor unveiled the first 11 sites and introduced OregonProspector.com. This was the first statewide GIS-based industrial lands database in the nation. There are now 38 certified sites, 17 of which are either partially or fully developed or have a
pending project. One success story associated with the certified sites is the Lowe's site in Lebanon. I trust you're all familiar with that. There's some history behind that site. In 2001, a plastic pipe manufacturer was very interested in the site. After months of negotiations, all parties had reached an agreement only to discover there were 70 acres on the site that were impacted by wetlands, and it could take up to 2 years or more to mitigate the problem. Needless to say, the site, the deal was killed. In 2004, this site was one of the original 11 sites. Within 6 months of its certification, Lowe's expressed an interest in the site, and today they are building a 1.4 million square foot distribution facility that will employ over 700 Oregonians. I'd like to read a paragraph to the governor's office from Donald Wynn, the director of engineering and construction for Lowe's, that serves to underscore the importance of the program. And I can make these available. I have extra copies if you'd like to read the whole letter.
I would like to ask you to make that available to the professional staff as well as the website for OregonProspector.com so the committee members can go there and peruse the website independently.
Absolutely. I think it's a very good suggestion. We're going to put success stories on the website that you mentioned earlier. There's many things the department's done, and we're going to have Oregon Prospector list those successes as well as Oregon for Bills. So there's a number of sites you can go to look at the successes of the department. Mr. Wynn says, typically making every effort to fast-track our due diligence and entitlements on these regional distribution center sites, we require 8 to 12 months to secure permits. On sites with special issues such as significant wetlands or environmental concerns, it is not uncommon to spend 18 to 24 months to secure permits. Our last project had 6 acres of impacted wetlands, requiring a Corps of Engineers individual permit, and took 14 months to permit. Our site in Lebanon had 70 acres of impacted wetlands, requiring a Corps of Engineers individual permit, which was received in 3 months. This success was a direct result of the state's efforts involving all local, state, and federal agencies in the program expended on our site prior to our introduction to the site. Not only had all the agencies been involved in the review of the site with associated development issues, but all had participated in identifying potential solutions to these issues, which saved considerable time once we started our due diligence efforts. Pretty strong statement from a large company.
Mr. McCabe, I think one of the questions that pops into people's mind when they read that is that we all have sites in our districts where people have actually died waiting to get certification. And this is a question that you may not be able to answer, but I think it's one that I'd like to pose to the agency. And that is why we can't get this level of cooperation to help on the kind of sites that Senator Morris Anderson mentioned earlier, where it seems as though bringing the might of the state to focus on a site, leverage the core, leverage some of the other federal impediments, we can move sites to a point of certification very quickly. And I think one of the dilemmas that I've wrestled with is, why site A and not site B? How did they get into the pipeline? How do I bring my site forward? And why should I, as a private citizen, be the beneficiary of the might of the state of Oregon in bringing my site up to developable standards? For me, it's a question of process and regularizing or formalizing how sites come forward to be put into the process. I completely agree with the outcome, and I think it's highly desirable that Oregon has an inventory of available sites. What's been a conundrum for me is how the sites are selected and where the state gets a payback as a result of bringing the power of the state of Oregon to get a site certified.
Right. Ron Fox is much more qualified to address that than I am.
We invite Mr. Fox up for a pithy comment.
It's a very good point, and the communities actually put the sites forward to the community department and request that they be certified. So it's the communities, and correct me if I'm wrong there, but it's the community's responsibility
to identify sites that they want certified.
Teeing off of that, I just want to ask Mr. Bryant and Mr. MacArthur, when you come up, I would like your comments on how regularized you think the process is to engage cities or counties to make sure that your local priorities have a shot at getting into the pipeline. Mr. Fox.
Chairman Johnson, members of the committee, I think early in the effort to both develop the criteria for certified project ready sites and identify those sites that could be brought forward early on, we went through an evaluation of almost 160 sites across the state of Oregon. We put actually a list of 160 locations in rural, urban, and suburban communities. Out of that, using the knowledge of even people such as Tim, who works closely with us on a lot of expansion projects, our business development officers who are familiar with the community capacities, we identified a shorter list than 160 that we identified as our first efforts to try to bring forward through the certification process. And I think Tim actually brought a book that represents the documentation of this process. So those sites were identified a couple of ways. One, they had willing owners. They had willing communities prepared to engage in the process. And it is an involved process. There's nothing in the certification process that any business would not have to complete and address if they were to develop on a site without the prior certification. So out of that initial screen, we identified some priority sites we felt had initial market readiness and market acceptability, that had willing owners, and that's one of the initial requirements of the certification, is that a site have an owner willing and prepared to offer a letter of sale and price on the property. So we don't want to engage in this work on a site that is not available for sale and not available at a price that could be...
Do you set the price prior to the rehab or after the rehab?
Senator Johnson, the owner of the property sets the suggested retail price for their property. We may counsel with them and say, we believe your price is above what market characteristics will be, but it's the owner's decision to set that price. You asked one of your earlier questions was, what is the return to the state for certification? I think there are two things. One, in staying with the example of the site in Lebanon, I have to say I have a history with that site that goes back about 17 years when I worked for a prior employer. We tried to develop that site and eventually gave up because of the same issues that Tim alluded to before. The challenge of developing that site, while it was zoned properly and it was the city was a willing participant, the challenges of getting all of the issues addressed in a timely manner continually put prospective site users, businesses who are willing to make significant investments. They said it's too long of an uncertain window to be able to make that development. But I think in the Lowe's case, I think the return to the state of Oregon is with the development of that site, the state will, the local communities will benefit by the property tax receipts that will come from this new investment over time. The state will also benefit from the personal income tax receipts that will come as a result of the initial jobs and up to 700 jobs that will be employed in that facility. So the state's return is in those ways, and it's using the land that has been through our land use planning process identified as an appropriate site with adjacent capacities to serve industrial purposes. So I think those are some of the benefits that accrue to Oregon and the local community by that process.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. What type of relationship are these sites going to have with Connect Oregon, the $100 million investment the state made?
Chair Johnson, Representative Smith, I think the initial sites that Tim alluded to that have completed the certification, I think 38 is the current number. I believe there's another 9 or 10 that are just completing the final details, and I think we're eventually going to be very close to either 48 or 49 sites that have reached this level of preparedness for development. Most of those sites have the capacity to serve off-site and on-site transportation requirements. Now, any one particular user on one of these sites may have a transportation requirement, rail service, an extra heavy-duty road access that may make it necessary to seek additional funding for those types of infrastructure services. So I would say Connect Oregon, in terms of an opportunity venue, would clearly be a possibility, along with the public infrastructure funding and support capacities the department has through its programs that you heard of earlier.
Representative Smith, thank you. Just a recommendation. I would strongly suggest that because the state has decided that we're going to make two major investments. One, I think, what did we do, $45 million this last session? $45 million into these industrial sites. We've done $100 million into Connect Oregon. I would sure hope the left hand knows what the right hand is doing. I know the application deadline for Connect Oregon is the 17th of February, 10 days ago or so. And I would just hope that you folks are making connection with the Department of Transportation on that.
I think I, on behalf of both committees, with Representative Lim's concurrence, I think I'd like to make sure that that gets transmitted back to the Department of Transportation. It seems so obvious. I'm glad Representative Smith brought it to our attention to make sure that some kind of prioritization or at least acknowledgement in the grant review process speaks to the connection between those two. That's a great idea.
And I'm going to make a couple more comments, closing comments, while what site selectors say about the program, but I'd like to go back to what Representative Lim asked a little bit earlier, and Mike responded that business retention is one of the most important things, and it's the first priority of the department. This certified site is very important for that. When a company, whether it's inside Oregon or outside of Oregon, decides to expand, when they've made that decision, things start happening much more rapidly than they used to. These decisions that used to take 2 years now take 6 months or 2 months. And if these lands aren't available for companies inside of our state, they are going to go elsewhere. So I think this, from that perspective, this project is very important to continue. In addition to that, I'd just like to say these are economic development people, site selectors that I work with and the state works with on an ongoing basis, and these are the things they say about it. At a presentation at the International Economic Development Council, Dean Foote of Carter Burgess was asked if states should get involved with site certification. His response was, and I quote, "Setting standards and site certification is the direction that states should be going, and the states with the best programs are Oregon and South Carolina." Okay. During his presentation at the Utility Economic Development Association Forum, Don Sheldahl of the Austin Company stated that Oregon is setting the standard for site certification. At the same forum, Bill Fredericks of the Wadley Donovan Group said that Oregon Certified Site Program, coupled with Oregon Prospector, sets it apart from other states. I think it's imperative that our state and the department continue to lead the way in innovative economic development activities. We're in a global economy now. If we don't do this stuff, we're not going to be seen, and it's important.
Representative Fetcher. Thank you, Madam Chair. Just for my clarification, you talked about 17 of the 38 certified sites as being fully developed.
Partially or a project.
Oh, okay. And does that? How many are actually occupied with actual industries employing actual people?
Well, there's portions of them. A lot of them are like 50 acres, and some of them have been subdivided, and there are small businesses now that are occupying 25 acres of the 50. We can give you the exact names of the businesses. An example that everybody knows is company Google took up the whole site in the Dalles, Lowe's, the whole site in Lebanon. But of the other ones we're talking about, portions of those sites are being developed. But we can give them the exact figures about how many the sites actually have been developed or partially developed.
If Mr. Fox would get that to the professional staff and out to the committee.
Chairman Johnson and members of the committee, I guess the Tim's reference to 38 sites with an additional 9 or 10 sites pending. We are utilizing 17 or portions of those sites already. That's one of the challenges the agency faces. Is if we have some success and those bring investments and job opportunities and affiliated benefits, where will the next 17 sites be located, and can we make those ready in time to meet both expansion opportunities of existing businesses, but also new investments that create the kind of top, high-level, high-skill jobs that we would pursue.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. McCabe. I know you've taken I know you've taken time away from work to be here, and I appreciate you doing that. Now that we're still on this theme of clusters, I'm going to ask Ms. Kennedy to come up.
Good afternoon, Chair Johnson and members of the committee. My name is Debbie Kennedy, and I have the great honor of being director of a program called Brand Oregon. And I like to describe Brand Oregon as a concept that applies the principles of private sector branding to state agencies, to people, products, and places, using a unified look and feel and a tone of voice to pull together all of the messaging and branding for all state agencies and state communications. We have dozens of state agencies that are participating in Brand Oregon through unifying the look and feel of their websites, and specifically three agencies that we are working on a proactive basis with in the early days of Brand Oregon, and those are agriculture, tourism, and economic development. And for the purposes of today's presentation, Chair Johnson has asked me to focus on economic development. I can talk another time quite happily about agriculture and tourism. So specifically on the subject of economic development, last February of 2005, we launched our first ever business recruitment campaign, and we spent a lot of time in the Brand Oregon board discussing whether this campaign should be targeted at vertical industry segments or if it should be geographic in approach, and we decided on a hybrid. We decided geographically to focus on California, since one in five CEOs in California in a recent survey said that they are actively looking to move out of the state. And then we also decided to go nationally to a vertical target, which is site selectors. So starting in 2005, we've been running Brand Oregon advertisements in publications in California, such as California CEO, Fortune Small Business, and business journals around the state, as well as national site selector pubs. Naturally, this has generated a lot of publicity in California and also outside California, as has Brand Oregon in general. I'm proud that Oregon's leading the way on the notion of branding a state, and we have subsequently been followed by Brand Philadelphia, Brand Atlanta, and most recently Brand Colorado. And I've been happy to advise destinations at least 1,500 miles away from Oregon, but I got a call from the Fletching office of Brand Idaho last week and accidentally hung up on them. Oops. And in addition to our general business recruitment campaign, we have a cluster-specific campaign, since so much of what the Oregon Business Council is focusing on with Duncan's work and also OECD, it seemed only logical that Brand Oregon should focus on the clusters. And once again, it was a difficult decision choosing which clusters to launch initially, since a recent survey of the state's clusters conducted by Oregon Business Council, 60% of the clusters have indicated that in their top five priorities, it's working with Brand Oregon on messaging campaigns. So it was a difficult decision, but as follow-up to Amy Carter's talk, we've chosen three, and the first one is the digital display cluster, and I'm sure you've all seen the Brand Oregon campaign. It's most visible through its tourism iteration, and usually focuses on a particular person to tell the Oregon story. In the case of the digital display cluster, Alan Alley from Pixelworks.
Debbie, actually, we have that picture. They just passed it out.
Oh, here. Okay.
Thank you.
One of the questions in our most recent Brand Oregon board meeting is, how do you choose the company that you feature, since it appears like it's somewhat of a boon for the company? And the reality is that not every company wants to be featured. There are certain companies in Oregon that don't feel as positive for their brand to identify closely with our state. For example, Tillamook Cheese, which says that in California they're thought of as a California company and they don't want to disrupt that notion. Alan Alley very, very clearly self-identified as someone who wanted to be a part of this campaign, so we welcomed his cooperation. In addition to the digital display cluster, I'm going to hand out the media plan for our second two cluster focuses, the second one being My personal favorite, warm place in my heart for the sports footwear and apparel and sports equipment cluster. This cluster seems to be growing all by itself without the help of Brand Oregon, but nonetheless, we have a very exciting campaign in the works. The company that we're going to feature is a company called Now, N-A-U, and we chose them because, you know, we thought if you chose a Nike or a Columbia, an out-of-state company would look at that and say, well, of course, you know, they're so huge there in Oregon. I'm a small company. How do I fit into this? And Now is a startup. Five out of eight of Now's employees have been were formerly directors at Patagonia, and their other four senior managers all come from senior positions at Nike. The president of Now, whose name is Chris Van Dyke, could have chosen, he was from Patagonia, he could have chosen anywhere in the country to start his company, and he had three reasons for choosing Oregon. He said, number one, from a workforce point of view, if you're going into this cluster, there's nowhere to be other than Oregon because of the quality of workers from this cluster that are available, skilled creative designers, manufacturing folks, sourcing folks, distribution folks. Oregon's the place to be. Number two, one of Now's corporate ethos is giving back. They're going to be giving 5% of their revenues to nonprofits in the environmental sector. And number three, they're going after a very unusual business model, which is called a web front, a cross between a retail location and a web distribution system. And they thought Oregon was the perfect place to start something new like this. Because of the quality of the folks on the Now launch team, this is being very, very closely watched by the sports industry and leaders in this cluster. And Chris Van Dyke just and his team just did a briefing at our agency wide in Kennedy, and the sound bites went on for what is going to turn out to be, I think, just the perfect testimonial for why Oregon. I was at a meeting this morning with another group of people, and you hear every day. Yesterday there was a press release about Keene Footwear. Their advertising agency 4040 is moving to Portland in order to support Keene. And then just this morning I heard about an Israeli company that's moving from Israel, who has just moved from Israel to Lake Oswego, who supplies fabric in the technical apparel industry. So it's growing, and it's enormously exciting for Oregon. The third cluster that we're focusing on is recreational vehicle manufacturing, which I knew absolutely nothing about a month ago. But I'm now amazed to tell you that if you go on the website for Celebrity Coach, the starting price is $1.5 million. I don't know who buys these. And on up. And they employ, just in recreational vehicle manufacturing alone in Lane County, there are 5,000 jobs. And I know that we have at least four leads of the most recent RV show in Florida, companies that are interested in moving to Oregon. And the meeting I had this morning was about doing a very, I think, interesting, more guerrilla-style campaign, because I'm wondering in my own mind if traditional advertising works against this cluster, and we're considering the notion of a guerrilla campaign in a cross-promotion between tourism and RV manufacturing, having to do with come to Oregon to pick up your vehicle and visit Oregon first and all the ramifications of that. So that's a brief introduction to Brand Oregon and clusters. I know that this group will be watching very closely to see what kind of success we have, and I'm just excited that in the work that Duncan Weiss's organization has done, that 60% of his cluster folks listed Brand Oregon as one of their top five priorities in their initiatives for this next year.
Ms. Kennedy, before you close, could you comment a little on the Oregon Bounty campaign and the marketing of the bounty from Oregon's rivers, our fields, forests? Could you talk a little bit about the success of that program?
Happily, this is one of our cross promotions with tourism, agriculture, and Brand Oregon. Oregon Bounty was launched in the fall of 2004. It was a first ever campaign, and it was a cross promotion between some very unlikely bedfellows, which were the Pear Bureau, the Hazelnut Commission, the Dairy Council, the Wine Board, the Oregon Tourism Division, and Brand Oregon, which doesn't sound like it goes together at all, but the notion was visit any one of 60 participating Oregon wineries in the fall of 2004 and get free samples of Oregon's cheeses, pears, and hazelnuts matched with different wine varietals. Brand Oregon leveraged a $50,000 investment from our funds to a $400,000 campaign funded by tourism and the commissions. And we had absolutely stunning results in year one. We had a 50% increase in traffic to the wineries and a 60% increase in wine sales, which is literally unheard of results in consumer marketing. This year, Oregon Bounty 05, this year which was our second year, it was pay to play for the wineries. They had to contribute funds to become an Oregon Bounty winery. We again had 60 participants. This time we had 75 restaurants sign up to be official Oregon Bounty restaurants, saying that they would serve only Oregon Bounty foods during the month of November. And we had 200 grocery stores, including chain of Safeway, that did displays and demonstrations on Oregon commodities and products. We've just done our post survey on the wineries that participated, which is the easiest place to measure results because you have actual folks coming in just for that reason. And, I can't understand this. The Oregon Wine Board was somewhat apologetic when they presented the results. They said, well, only 45% of the wineries said they had an increase in traffic from out of state. I thought any consumer marketer would kill for those kind of results. So I think it's going to be a long-term partnership and its own sort of sub-brand that will establish itself in people's minds as a thing to do in November in Oregon. And I'm sure Senator Johnson would want me to mention that we are now exploring the notion of bookending Oregon Bounty in November with Coastal Bounty in May, which is when all of our seafood species are in season on the Oregon coast, where we'd feature all kinds of activities up and down the coast and bring people to our number one tourist destination in an off-season, which is what they desperately need.
It is my opinion that one of the places that Brand Oregon can really shine, and this takes off on something that Representative Lynn mentioned, is in talking about food and the amount of food tourism that occurs. People traveling to Oregon so they can be here for the chanterelle season and pairing that with other indigenous food. I had the opportunity to have a conversation with Junkie Yoshida, who does a cookery show in Japan that's watched by 15 million people. And each year it's on. He is very eager to have the opportunity to take visiting Oregon chefs to Oregon, cooking with Oregon products, and then marketing back trips to come to Oregon to either be up in the high desert or come out to Oregon country beef and then take those products back to Japan, where the purity, sustainability, origin of food are very highly valued. And it's his opinion, and I have to rely on the fact that he sells food all over the world. It's his opinion that Oregon could occupy a very significant niche with respect to featuring our food and the method of the production of our food, a la high country beef, to the Pacific Rim, and he believes with great success. Any questions of Ms. Kennedy? Senator Nelson.
Maybe not a question particularly. I would talk about clusters and the worldwide competition and other things. Oregon has 11 trans-Pacific fiber optic cables that come into our state. I think we only have an off-ramp for one. I mean, if we're going to put all this stuff together, if anybody has any information on how can we develop that, it's a communication thing. And we have a cluster of trans-Pacific cables.
Fortuitously, one of the experts is a constituent of mine, Scott McMullen, and I'm sure
if I can get some information, maybe it's not a question for Ms. Kennedy.
Any other questions for Ms. Kennedy?
Great job.
Thank you for making the effort to come down and be with us this afternoon. I'm going to invite AOC and LOC to come up together as the local government perspective on the relationship with the agency and perhaps to address some of the questions that the committee has raised with respect to how the state agency blends with and is complementary to and helpful to local government.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Mike MacArthur with the Association of Oregon Counties. First of all, I'd like to applaud the committees for joining Chair Lim and Chair Johnson for getting this together. In my recollection, there's been no effort like this since about 1998 to take, during the interim, a comprehensive look at our economic development efforts in Oregon. I think it's sorely needed.
Well, this also gives me a public chance to apologize for having an agenda that's very high level and way too full, and we're already starting to execute people off of it, so we will end on time and have
have the opportunity for public testimony. Go ahead.
One other thing I'd like to note is that the governor recently asked me to chair a renewable energy work group, which is going to move forward on some recommendations from the renewable energy work plan. And I might suggest to Ms. Kennedy that they add to their RV marketing campaign that we fill up with biodiesel before they leave the state. But anyway, that work group, I think it has some subjects before it that might concern this committee. And Chair Johnson, if you would permit me, I'd like to come back sometime and talk about that work here, see those connections.
I will ask the professional staff to note that.
First of all, thank you for inviting me today, and I'd like to ask the committee's indulgence in perhaps taking a little excursion mentally into a fantasy. If you would imagine for a moment that you changed your career to pursue your public service more closely at home, and ran for county commissioner, and were elected.
Nuts.
And think about that for a minute, and think about yourself in the courthouse in Heppner, or Pendleton, or McMinnville, or wherever you may be residing, whichever county you're in, and think about what you might find when you arrive at that position as a county commissioner. And I'm sure you'll go get the budget to make sure you can find all that waste, fraud, and abuse that's there. But when you get into that budget, I think what you'll see is that the compensation costs for your county employees are increasing exponentially, with the double-digit health care costs of PERS still going up. However, because of the property tax limitation, and that's your major source of revenue, limited at 3% growth, you can't keep up. And the only way under the current Oregon system that you can keep up is to grow your economy locally and to grow your property tax base. So how do you do that? Well, that's economic development. And most commissioners at some level or another are heavily involved in economic development. And it varies greatly across the state how that looks. You have to have capacity. So when you're sitting there in your office in the county courthouse thinking about how you're going to do economic development, you first start looking around for, where are the people that are going to help me do this? And is there a plan? Who are my partners? What resources do we have? And think about your own county, and think about that question in your own county, and what exists there or doesn't exist there. How does it work in your county? And it's very different from county to county. As I scope the landscape for counties, I think I kind of put them into different categories. There's the hunter-gatherer types, which is where I came from, Truman County. Very basic, trying to get resources wherever you can, looking for opportunities wherever you can.
Cluster for that out there.
There are the counties that are more fit with an agrarian model, where they've got something to work with and they're actually growing it. There are the counties that are more industrial, which are actually turning out businesses. The Chutes might come to mind. There are counties that are technologically advanced. Washington comes to mind. Then there are counties I would put in the agnostic category, or even heretical category, and I think we may be coming around to that time again where people are looking closely at growth. In order to try and dramatize this to you, I decided to put together a colored chart, which is up on the overhead. This is very crude and very quickly done, and I apologize for some of the way it's laid out, and it's a work in progress, but we have AOC's had some luck with color charts and legislators, so I thought I'd go down that route again. But what I tried to do here is show you the landscape. So you see in the blue column yourself as a county. Now, obviously, there's a whole lot of other things that happen at the county level, but your interface in economic development, first you look to regional organizations that are doing what you do. And that green column lists those most commonly found across the state. Federal economic development districts, resource conservation and development districts. That's a repetition, their conservation district. Area Commission on Transportation, regional investment boards. SBDC's afterthought, but it's on there. Workforce investment, SBDC, Small Business Development Centers, workforce investment, and so on. Then you see the list of state departments that you're probably going to end up working with to do any kind of reasonable amount of economic development. And that runs the list of all those involved with the community, economic revitalization team, community solutions, as we used to call it, and those who participate in the community development forum. You've also got tribal governments to work with. And then at the bottom, these days, in order to move economic development, you frequently end up working with the private not-for-profits in many projects, particularly in rural Oregon. We know that. At the center there is the governor's economic revitalization team, and the graphic doesn't really show you how they interface with the local economic development efforts. Go down to the city level, port level, and you can see all the local partners on the right-hand side that you'll be working with. All those folks have an interest in economic development, too. And like I say, it varies from county to county. So what do you need, as a county commissioner sitting there, from a statewide organization in order to move forward with economic development? I would submit this list. You need people in the field from the department, people who are traveling out to see where you live and who can speak for the department with authority. And we have that have had it in the form of regional development officers. We have that from the governor's office in the form of their in the regional economic revitalization team members. I would say you need an agency to be coordinated internally so that when you talk to one part of the agency, you don't have to repeat that to different parts of the agency. I think there's great strides being made with the agency under Mike, and we have great faith in Director Rapine to continue that work there to organize the agency more efficiently. We need a place where there's centralized infrastructure financing. That's essential. I think you'll hear that from my colleague here. You need a centralized business finance program. You need someone to direct the leads that come to the Oregon for business locations. Now, Senator Johnson, you may ask the question about the industrial lands coordination. I would say from my experience as a local elected official, it was very well coordinated. I also had the luck of serving on the industrial lands task force that went through the process of vetting those various sites. And I think we were turning over every rock we could trying to find sites that might qualify and move forward those that were easiest to get to the level of certification. Now, the problem with that whole process is that it takes local capacity. We don't have people to send out to certify, do the work to certify the sites. So, for instance, in Representative Smith's district, when there was an industrial site that needed an environmental assessment, there was nobody there to do it and no resource to do it with. So, unfortunately, that didn't move forward as fast as it might have. So you need capacity and resources to move these sites forward. So I hope there is a connection with Oregon. Many of these sites, good sites, had transportation inhibitors. And so I'm hoping that Connect Oregon can help deal with that problem. Another thing that I think we could develop better and is a need at the local level is some type of entrepreneurial fund with local discretion. I think that we have an entrepreneurial fund at the state level, but I think if you had regional investment boards that had access to an entrepreneurial fund so they can help small businesses overcome obstacles, get started, get a little bit of seed capital to get them going.
I don't disagree with that, but I think what I'd like to do is to see if there's a venue in which we can expand that conversation, because accountability for those funds and what level of risk the local entrepreneurial expenditures are going to be willing to suffer, I think is one of the rub issues between the legislature and the agency. Who's making the decisions to give away how much money to who, and how do we collectively decide there was adequate ROI, or did we just throw money away on some project that was so poorly developed it couldn't qualify for commercial lending?
And someday when we do have a broader discussion about that, I would like to incorporate when local governments, as well as the state government, makes a decision about which particular business they're going to invest in, which is usually the less risky business, meaning the stronger business, does that not give a competitive advantage to that business in a free enterprise system and make it more difficult for the other businesses to compete? And is that really the role of government? Now, that horse is so far out of the barn, it's almost maybe not worth revisiting. But I think it's a question that should be answered by the government entities that are funding businesses.
I'm going to ask the professional staff to flag that for an additional conversation. I hope there's another opportunity for these two committees to come back together again. That one just seems to be critically important in many people's opinion. Go ahead, Mr. Professor.
Senator Johnson, you hit on accountability, and I think that one of the issues that we have with the current system is the performance measures that are used to measure whether economic development is successful or not. And our contention here is that they need to be more flexible. What works in some parts of the more fast-growing part of the state to measure job creation doesn't work in rural Oregon. And so we need a more regional approach, I think, a more flexible approach to performance measures. The last thing I would say is needed here, Mr. Bryant and I will talk about this in a little more detail, is the coordination between agencies. You see, all those state agencies that are involved in economic development, they need to be talking to each other. And there needs to be a place for that to happen. And there needs to be coordination and problem solving. And that exists today, what's known as the Community Development Forum. And we offered a letter of invitation to Chair Johnson, Chair Lim, and it should be extended to all the members of the committee, to participate with the Community Development Forum in discussing these issues.
We'll get that letter of invitation to everybody.
I would defer then to my colleague, Mr. Bryant.
Mr. Bryant, welcome.
Thank you,
Director
Johnson, Chair Lim. I am Steve Bryant, and I'm the interim executive director for the League of Oregon Cities. Prior to this stint, I spent 31 years in economic development, both as a planning director and city manager for the city of Albany. As you know, the League of Oregon Cities represents 241 incorporated cities around the state, each with its very distinct needs and issues, and part of the theme that I'm hearing today is it has to do with the regional differences that you deal with, and certainly that we deal with as a league and an association. Looking at the working draft of the mission statement and the objectives that was presented earlier, I really commend the direction that is headed. If I were to suggest the addition of a working objective that would resonate with the theme I heard, it would be something like recognize and support the unique regional characteristics and needs of Oregon's communities. It seems to me we could use some acknowledgement that I think exists within the department that they are working with a very diverse state, and that what's true in one part of the state is certainly not true in another part of the state, and one size does not fit all. With that said, the mission statement itself, I think, is very good, and it recognizes that the department is about preparing communities to do economic development, and much of what you've heard today adds a lot of meat to that statement, and we greatly appreciate that. You know, the old adage in real estate was location, 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 and while that still may be true, I would submit that the new theme of economic development for communities is infrastructure, infrastructure, infrastructure. It's a theme that you've heard today, and it's very true that our ability as communities to deliver on economic development is directly tied to the condition of our infrastructure. And you know, because you deal with it all the time, that the state's infrastructure is in dire need of support. Transportation is obviously the big one. We deal with sewer systems and water systems and local street systems and storm sewer systems that are in dire need of maintenance. We're simply falling further and further behind with just the day-to-day maintenance of those very expensive and complicated systems. In terms of economic development and retaining jobs, that's a critical component of what we do. We've got to find a better way to make sure that we can maintain these aging systems, and then to deliver the capacity to enable us to grow and attract new businesses, we've got to find better funding mechanisms to get out there to these sites that we would like to have certified, but we lack the funding mechanism that is sufficient to deliver the infrastructure. Again, each of those pieces is enormously expensive, and we need funding partners. The state's taking some steps in the right direction there. Unfortunately, it's sort of a proverbial drop in the bucket compared to the need that exists, and it's just a challenge that we all face. And I don't have a solution for you. I just submit that that's an enormous challenge that we have.
Mr. Brent, I'm going to interrupt you. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Johnson. You raised the question about infrastructure investment. Do we have communities who are making application to the state for water and sewer who are not being funded as a result of limited resources?
I would say that the needs greatly exceed the amount that is made available. There's no question about that. There's two issues. One is a capacity issue of people at the local level to write the applications when they know that the pie is very small and they know the competition is stiff. And the other is meeting the criteria. It's difficult. We've got the certified site problem of trying to get those sites serviced, and you know the competition.
Hey, what my question is, let me rephrase.
Follow up.
I've never heard of a community being turned down on an application because there wasn't adequate funding.
Representative Smith, if I could venture a guess there, I would say it happens all the time, particularly from the standpoint of grant dollars. Loan dollars are generally available, and the department does a pretty good job of making revolving loan funds available at low interest rates. The ability of local governments to find a funding source to repay those loans is the problem. So when I started in this business, the federal government typically funded anywhere from 60% to 90% of things like sewage treatment systems and water treatment systems and even transmission lines. Those dollars simply are not there any longer, and the communities are very reluctant to pass large utility rate increases to pay for that needed capacity before the end user is there.
Thank you. I'm going to invite a comment from Lynn Beaton with the agency that might help instruct the answer. Ms. Beaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lynn Beaton, and I guess I'm the interim deputy director for a couple of more weeks, and then assistant director. Representative Smith is correct. We don't really turn people down. What we do is work with them in a queue. And we work with them to get an application that is something that is fundable, both from their perspective and something from our perspective. We work from engineering standards and from fund availability, et cetera. So what we have is a very lengthy queue where the ones going up near the top are the ones with the greatest need, that we've been able to work through those application issues so that we know exactly what's going to be constructed and how it will be repaid. And then as we are able to work with communities to define those terms, they move up the queue. Now, at any one time, there will be no way to pay everybody or fund everything on that list. So it's a question of timing as years go on and we get funds repaid through the revolving loan fund and can move on and pay the additional ones. Exactly.
I might just add, being one of those communities, it causes some near-death experience among small sewer and water districts when they think they're in the queue, they think their financing package is together, and they find out that they've got to be part of a quilt of money that's knitted together. It's a process that, from my perspective, could use a little streamlining because it always comes as a surprise. We can't pay for it. We'll help you, but...
One of the partners, Chair Johnson, is USDA for rural Oregon. They're a huge funding source when it comes to infrastructure.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr.
Chair. If I speak just from experience for a moment, in my last couple of years with the City of Albany, we funded the largest public works project ever in our history, which was a new water treatment plant, a joint project with the City of Norrisburg. It was $36 million, for which we raised community water rates 28% the first year, and then subsequent rate increases in the range of 4 to 5%. A huge shock to the community. That was being followed up by what will far exceed that in terms of expense, about a $60 million sewage treatment plant replacement project, which means that sewer rates are going up 9 to 10% per year, have been for the last 5 or 6 years to build capital, and will continue to go up at those rates for the foreseeable future. But the state has been very helpful in terms of making revolving loan fund dollars available at low interest rates, which save our citizens a lot of money, but it's still very expensive. And that's addressing just the existing needs. It doesn't address much in the way of capacity in terms of getting those lines out to those industrial lands that need to be constructed to make those lands truly available and certifiable. So an enormous challenge for it. While I mentioned the certified site process, there's three issues that communities face that are of concern to us, and we're headed in the right direction. Don't get me wrong. I think that the program is a good program. We like it. But those issues are usually revolve around the land approval process. A lot of times there are land use issues that need to be resolved to get a site approved. Sometimes that can require an extension to an urban growth boundary, a comprehensive plan amendment, zone change, and you're familiar with the land use issues surrounding that, and that takes a lot of time and effort.
Now, certainly the infrastructure limitations I've already touched on. We've got to find sources of infrastructure funding to get those sites serviced. And then, as Mike mentioned, the capacity to actually put the applications together. It's fairly intimidating for a small community to wade through the paperwork to get a site certified. So what we need is to build up the capacity within regions, perhaps, or within the department to assist communities in getting those sites through the system. So those are the three challenges there. I want to say that there are a number of tools the department is now offering that are very helpful to us. I mentioned revolving loan funds. The Enterprise Zone Program was a key in Albany when we attracted something akin to the Lowe's Distribution Center in Lebanon. We attracted, with this state's help, the department's help, the Regional Distribution Center for Target Warehouse, or Target Stores, or Target Warehouse. Similar size, 500 to 600 employees, getting state assistance for infrastructure, putting Enterprise Zone in place, all those things were critical tools that helped us do that. Lastly, let me say that the state has been of great help to us through the economic recovery teams, as Mike mentioned. The state coordination continues to improve through organizations like the Community Development Forum. But the issue that Mike also touched on that I also want to mention is the need to continue to work at state agency coordination to make sure that we know who is directing the objectives for economic development in the state and that those agencies are working toward the same mission. Small example might be the fact that 2 years ago the governor directed SCDC to work on Goal 9, the economy of the state goal. It's unclear to us as to how much coordination there is between OECD and LCDC in terms of ensuring that goal development and the rules that follow those goals are consistent with the department's mission in working with local communities to make economic development happen at the local level. So we sometimes question, at least, where the direction is coming for arriving at the desired goal in terms of economic development when you have different initiatives happening in different departments. In terms of ODOT, the transportation plan rule is another great example of that. Trying to force coordination is a key. I think we're moving in the right direction throughout my career in the state. I continue to see progress there, but it's something you constantly have to work at. We appreciate the effort of the GERT. Ray Knapp has been wonderful to work with. Reform, getting the state players together at those meetings has increased communication tenfold. So we appreciate and applaud those efforts.
Thank you very much. You commented on coordination, and this is a chance, I guess, to ask you your reaction to the perception that sometimes the lack of coordination between the state and local government has resulted in projects being able to shop for good deals. I'm aware of the fact that there's a project now in Oregon that, parentheses, will need $100 to $150 million state investment to make it work, but I'm aware they're already starting to competitively shop communities. I lived through the Nucor experience of having different, I think Representative Smith's community and my community were courting the same company. How much of a problem has that been, or is that one of those mythologies that's kind of grown in this building and taken on a life of its own?
You want to take that one, Nick?
Yeah, sure.
I'll offer a response as well. I wouldn't say it's a serious problem. I think we're naturally competitive. I suspect Lebanon was a bit jealous when Albany got Target, and Albany was a bit jealous when Lebanon got Lowe's, but there fundamentally was recognition that those helped both communities, and that what's good for the state's economy is good for all of us. I would submit a bigger problem is the competition that exists between states, and it's something that we pay attention to even at the local level. I think that kind of competition is good.
We don't have a lot of resources to give away. Sometimes we feel like we have a competitive disadvantage, but really the onus is on us at the local level to get these sites ready to go. What I'm suggesting is that we all need to help with the infrastructure piece. And if we've got the sites zoned and ready and serviced, then naturally the businesses are going to choose to go where it makes the most sense for them.
Mike, what's your answer? I know how annoyed we all were with Nucor. Is that a real deal?
I haven't observed that to be a significant problem. The one that comes to mind is the relocation of Tillamook Dairy additional facilities, and there was good healthy competition, in my view, between the two sites that were in
competition.
Yeah.
We got it. Any other questions or comments for these two? Thank you, gentlemen. Oh, Representative
Toy. When you're talking about infrastructure, and so it seems to me that it may be the tendency of big companies who are coming in who want property that's going to be cheaper, so it's going to be further away from the urban area. So that may be cheaper property, but then it's income from the state or the local government to provide the infrastructure. So in a sense, we're subsidizing companies that do that kind of thing. Do you have a response to that?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Tony, I suppose that perception would be there, but for the fact that my experience has been those companies pretty much pay their weight. If we're able to get infrastructure in place, by the time they come in, there are systems development charges, there are local improvement district assessments, there are added transportation improvements that are required. So it's not as if we offer a lot of local incentives, because frankly we don't have a lot to give away. We compete against states, frankly, that have a lot more in the way of public giveaways than we're able to in Oregon. The enterprise zone arguably is a tax break that we offer businesses within those communities that have enterprise zones. My argument about that is that eventually returns additional tax dollars to the community when those incentives expire. You've got a business, in our case, Target Distribution Center, that added a tremendous amount of taxable value just in the last 2 years to our community that wouldn't have been there had they not come. And they've always told us they wouldn't have come but for the enterprise zone incentives. So that's an example of a business that, to my knowledge, isn't really competing with anybody else, and we haven't ever heard the argument that we offered incentives that wasn't similarly available to other distribution companies.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Bowman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I apologize. I have to take off at 4 o'clock with another prior commitment. I just wanted to share a couple of observations, not necessarily what this panel just spoke on. I was sworn in January 10 last year, and this is the first time I've truly felt like I've been drinking from a fire hose. This is overwhelming. But one thing that I've kind of been watching for and listening for all day is, where's the payoff? And I really haven't heard any real, you know, what have we done for our $380+ million community development funds? I think the closest we came was the discussion about the site certification and how that has worked and has demonstrated its effectiveness. And the other comment I'd like to leave you with is that if I understood what I believe, Mr. Bryant, you said, that we could use some regional resources to help local governments deal with the process, I would submit instead that we need to deal with the problem, and that's the process and not the symptom. Now, I don't know that much about the details, but anytime people say we need another layer on the onion to deal with it, I think we're dealing with the wrong problem. Thank you.
Madam Chair, can I ask one comment in response? And I certainly would be the last to suggest we need another layer of bureaucracy to help us work through these issues. But I do want to, give you sort of my mantra about economic development in terms of what works for communities in terms of what's the real payoff. And that is, I always said to our economic development folks and our planners that what we ought to be targeting are businesses and business expansion opportunities that are high value, low impact. The only way we're going to crawl out of this hole that we have as a state in terms of funding education, funding local government, funding state government, funding social services, are to generate those jobs that essentially pay more in taxes than they demand in services.
And so I think our recruitment efforts have to be targeted. We cannot be welcoming to every type of business, because frankly there are businesses out there that demand more in services than they pay in taxes, and that's not what's going to make this state successful. We've got to turn the tables on that and go after those business opportunities that are high value, low impact.
And Madam Chair.
Representative, so I'd like to know what companies are they demanding more services that the instead of paying taxes. Could you give us some examples?
I would say, if I were going on a limb, there are companies. So I'll go out on a limb. I've had experience with economic development agencies in my own community who spend a lot of time and resources attracting call companies that pay minimum wage jobs. And while we have citizens who would wait at the employment door to take those jobs, in the larger scheme of things, businesses that come to Oregon that pay minimum wage jobs with minimal health benefits will end up being a drain on our economy, because those jobs do not afford people the opportunity to take care of their health care needs. They don't contribute much in the way of education dollars. So I would say we shouldn't be, as a state, trying to attract those kinds of businesses. We should be focusing more on the businesses that offer benefits, that pay higher wages, that pay higher income taxes, and return something to our economy.
Thank you. Madam Chair, may I add one thing?
This will be the last comment.
Representative Burley's question. The question we hear so often is, are we getting our money's worth in our investment in economic development? And I think that is a very difficult measurement to make. And economic development is a very long-term process, and you need to stay at it and have the systems in place over a very long period of time to get the return in the quality of life that you're looking for, really. That's what you're looking for, and that's very difficult to measure. We do measure it in property taxes. We do measure it in income taxes. We measure it in jobs. But it needs to be viewed in a long-term process and not disrupted every time the legislature comes into session with some other direction. And this agency has been whipped back and forth over the years to the point where they're very unsure about what they're supposed to be doing sometimes, and that makes the process more difficult. So I hope we can take a long-term view here and recognize that the investments being made will pay off over time.
Representative Smith, and then that's it.
I concur with your comments, Mike.
Well, that added a lot. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I now invite Mr. Carter and the Small Business Development Center. Thank you, Representative Burley.
I followed your guidance. I followed your guidance.
Sorry, that was not very
professional.
Okay, was it?
I followed your guidance.
Good afternoon. Would you state your name for the record?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Carter. I'm the State Director for the Small Business Development Center Network, commonly known as the SBDC Network. The network office is located in Eugene, and there's 19 SBDC offices around the state. Madam Chair, you asked me to direct my comments today to the additional investment that the legislature made in the SBDCs during the last session. So I was fortunate that I have given you some background material. My apologies for not getting that to you a few days ago. It just came together this morning. The $1.1 million in extra investment for the SBDC is proposed by you is directed towards two principal initiatives. And for shorthand, let's just call the first one a tech initiative, and the second one is our eSBDC, and they are related. And I'll weave that together, see if I can do this in three floors of the elevator, because I know that we're a little bit pressed for time today. When I started 2.5 years ago, I had a lot of windshield time with Ron Fox as we traveled the state. And in those conversations, Ron indicated that that there was a category of small business that wasn't really well served either by the SBDCs or the microenterprise agencies, nor by the regional development offices at that point in time. We had conversations about that. And we might call those the existing businesses that have 5 to 20 employees. We refer to them as second stage businesses. They've moved through pre-venture, startup. They've been in business. They might be making money, but they have a lot of untapped potential. So I cataloged Ron's remarks. And as I continued my assessment, I looked at programs like the Oregon SBDC Network around the country. And was looking for best practices. There's 63 SBDC networks in the United States and its territories. There's actually about 1,100 SBDC service centers total. Oregon has 19. We can probably use 29 or 39. There's a lot of communities that just are a little bit too far up the canyon for the capacity that we have now. I asked for some additional investment based upon that analysis and that assessment in Ron's comments in order to reach these types of businesses and to also add a new type of service component to what the SBDCs do. That's what I'm referring to as the tech initiative. We know that there's a lot of fast-growing companies in Oregon. They're small. They have intellectual property issues. They have finding a market or commercialization issues, new types of capitalization, non-traditional funding. And when we looked at other networks, other SBDC networks around the country, we saw tremendous economic impact results when they started focusing on this type of company. If I could direct your attention to the Crispin study, if you look on page 4 towards the bottom of that study, in the handouts they gave on, it's called the Economic Impact of SBDCs in the United States, you'll notice that it gives an ROI figure for the SBDC investment around the country. And if you increase the number of hours that you spend with a small business, you go from an hour to 2 hours to 3 hours to 4 hours. If you work down that chart a little bit, you notice that it's just like coaching a baseball player or a soccer player or a volleyball player. If you make a significant additional investment as a coach, you're probably going to get additional returns from that player's participation in the game. And we know that's true. There's evidence that says if we start to refocus our capacity on fewer companies and give them more, we'll get greater economic investment. And I think the figure there is 8 to 1. So $8 come back to the general fund for every dollar in lottery fund would be the calculus that you could use based upon the Christmas studies. The studies go back for about 10 years. They're also complemented by the Campbell Long studies that the department funded over the last few years. So that creates a problem. If we want to have great economic impact, create an ROI, a return on your investment, which comes from the jobs that are created, do we have to trim, like the state of Vermont did, the number of clients that we serve by 3/4 or even 2/3? So instead of 6 or 7,000 council clients a year, maybe Oregon would only serve 1,500. So that creates a problem because we have multiple stakeholders, and we believe that there is a valid service to be given, even if it's only an hour. So we started looking at this problem as how do we maintain the quantity in that whole range of services, even though they don't have the strong economic impact. And we came up with the idea that we needed to rapidly, significantly expand our ability to deliver services via the Internet. And so we
framed this concept called the ESBDC. It's a lot more than a website. They've included some screenshots. It's almost ready for prime time, a couple more weeks. The ESBDC is an opportunity for businesses 24/7, 365 to reach a counselor, to reach resources, to get recommendations, to connect with each other in ways that are not available anywhere in the country. So this will be a national best practice, we expect. Why spend $40 of counselor time when you can deliver that service for 4 cents, or better yet, for 4/10 of a cent? So you can see that the two initiatives are intertwined, and if we're successful, we believe we will be, we will actually have a higher economic impact, and we'll probably serve significantly more businesses overall. Our current website, we have about 100,000 hits per year. But we don't know what they're doing there. We just know that they come to our current website. The website that we've designed will be able to measure everything, what type of assistance they requested, what type of document, and then from that baseline, we'll be able to modify our services. So that is an overview to the additional investment. I'm certainly willing to take some questions or provide follow-up information if you have some.
We're buying a computer system and a reporting mechanism?
We already own a server and lots of computers, so it's not about hardware. It's about service to small businesses. And the ESBDC is a channel of delivery requiring some development costs, just like the Secretary of State or the Economic Development Department have been on a e-government initiative to more cost-effectively make their services and their expertise available. This is the same thing with the additional element that it's highly interactive. There's actually a counseling component that we're hoping to build into this.
Just to follow up, how will you report back to the legislature the return on investment?
Madam Chair, that's a great question, and we believe that there's a range of reports that you need. First of all, if we've done a good needs assessment, the activity itself is one of the reports that you need. That is an indication that we have read the small business needs correctly and that we've responded appropriately. We might learn something in that. But those activities tend to lead towards certain types of interim indicators. For example, if you start with the premise that a business that's ready to capitalize in some form is a business that's ready to grow, and a growing business is going to hire, which is going to create that return, there's kind of the calculus that we might look at, then we would want to report back to you measures of capital formation. Are the SBDC counselors helping small businesses get a whole variety of loans and SBIR grants and Economic Development Department loan packages, and how are those being mixed? So
will the report back be, we saw 320 companies, or will the report back be, we saw companies A, B, C, D, and we helped them acquire whatever it is they needed?
We can do both, Madam Chair. We have a very precise case management system. There's a high degree of confidentiality brought into it. In order to present that to the public, a specific business that we assisted, we would ask for a release from that business so that we could share their success. Most businesses are more than willing to do it because it just promotes them. So yes, qualitative information and the whole range of quantitative information from the basic activity all the way through to the ROI that you see represented in this national study. The Christmas study is available for Oregon, but we have not elected to buy it. They're very expensive, and we were asked to participate in the
conscious of the Campbell-Long study, and so we just had to make a choice of which one that we would.
Just for my last comment, I'm very uninterested in seeing volume of activity. I am very interested in seeing outcome from that activity. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions, if I may. So will there be the ability of people who use this program and benefit from it, but at a certain point they need to talk with someone? Would there be the ability for them to meet the counselor?
You're referring to our ESBDC counselor?
Correct.
Representative, excuse me, Madam Chair. Yes, there's, in fact, if you kind of flip through some of those screenshots, you'll see that a small business person or an entrepreneur, regardless of the stage of their business, can sign in. And then they come back and they have an individualized website that they will interact with their specific counselor with.
Representative,
thank you. What I'm asking is, would a person be able to meet with a real person?
Yes. Yes. In fact, if I could clarify that, in addition to the extending the services to business people directly, we expect the counselors themselves to discover this as a way to create greater leverage in their own time and start interacting with their clients. But all they have to do is ask for counselor time, and it will be scheduled.
Thank you.
I guess I'm still struggling with being a little more precise in asking my question and hoping, I guess, for a little more precision in your answer. How are you guys going to measure your work and benchmark your success?
If I'm speaking to my stakeholders, the funding agencies, yourself from the Economic Development Department or the SBA, they're primarily interested in economic impact. And so I would think that the ROI, Madam Chair, would be the starting point for that discussion, you know, with a study like this. There's, I think, three predominant methodologies that are used to create an ROI for this type of activity. And I would be glad to start there. There's also, before you get to, the jobs that were created this much in additional public revenue, you have to be credible in with you, and yes, those jobs were a direct result of those activities. So,
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. I want to take another swing at that. How do you measure helping someone stay out of business? Who shouldn't be in business? How do you report that?
Well, I guess that would be a qualitative report that you saved their retirement or
the reason I throw that question, Barry, you're kind of in an awkward situation in that you're asked to show success and you're asked to report success, but at the same time measuring success can be very, very difficult. Part of your success may be helping that mom and pop who worked for 45 years for the state of Oregon, who now has perhaps a nest egg, helping them keep that nest egg rather than investing in a dream that's not going to pan out.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I agree with you. It is difficult, but I don't believe it's impossible. And I think that well intended, we could have that discussion, come to some agreement that the activity leads to the intermediate situation. They got the loan, they grew, and they hired, and they created jobs.
I want to push back.
Follow.
I want to push back. Okay. What about the company who is facing a bankruptcy? And your SBDC works with that company to make sure that they prudently and honestly handle the liquidation of their assets to ensure that community creditors get some return back on their money. How do you measure that?
I'm not sure you can measure it except
but I want to push it back on you.
Yeah.
You can't measure that, but doesn't that help other Main Street business owners, helping that one business to figure out how to liquidate their business in an honest manner?
Well, it might help that business owner as well preserve what he can out of the situation. Representative Smith.
I'm feeling kind of anxious about the fact that this important segment is getting sort of short shrift, and I think what I'd like to do for the benefit of both committees, if Representative Lynn concurs, is that you're getting an additional $1.1 million this biennium for a total of $3.3
million. That's correct.
And I think, if I recall correctly, part of the budget note was to include benchmarks. Have you developed those yet?
We're in the process of developing those.
How long until you think you're done?
I'm not sure. I would have to ask the department. We're ready.
Well, what I think I would like to ask you to do is to send a preliminary draft to the professional staff, make sure that they get out to the committee, and specifically, what if you could comment on what are the deliverables required in the contract, and make sure that we all, as the economic development committees on both sides of the building, understand those, and if you could get those back to writing, back in writing to the professional staff, we'll have the benefit of your thinking on that important issue.
Make one follow-up
sure.
comment, Senator. There are 63 SBDC networks around the country, and this is a discussion that we are all engaged in: is how do we know we're succeeding in a very complex type of problem? Next Monday, my colleagues are actually visiting with officials of the Office of Management and Budget on this same topic. So,
respectfully, Mr. Carter, we're only interested in one of them.
I know.
And so if you could get us back a draft, I think that would be great.
Okay.
Great. Thank you very much. And I apologize again for having such a full agenda. You've given an example of small businesses of 5 to 20 people, and I think one of the prime examples of these small businesses are liquor stores. Because of the large amount of revenue generated for the state by liquor stores, these small businesses, this seemed like an appropriate forum to just quickly ask the OLCC to come over and explain their methodology for evaluating the individual stores with respect to the agent compensation study that you're undertaking. I think specifically we'd like to know, what are your criteria? How are you accounting for regional differences, socioeconomic differences? The liquor stores in Senator Nelson's district are different from mine, and if you could just share with us the methodology, and if you would prefer to get it back in writing, that would be fine too.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Teresa Kaiser, the Executive Director of the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and I'm here by invitation today. Excuse me if I'm not immediately prepared on this subject, as I was a little unsure as to what the committee would want to hear about. We are looking at doing, as a result of our budget note, a study of the reasonableness of the agent compensation. As part of that, we are collaborating with agents as a team to make sure that as we go forward, we do ask the right questions.
How is that collaboration manifesting itself?
We've had initial discussions, but the stage we're at now is prior to engaging an outside consultant. We surveyed three of the top external groups that could possibly do this study as to the cost of such a study, which was not an easy study, as you pointed out, because of the differences. That figure is around $500,000. We will be coming forward to the e-board with that information at the April meeting, provided we make it through all the internal processes we have to go through to get there. The agency does not have a spare $500,000, and was not a, I don't know about you, I didn't anticipate these kinds of studies were that expensive. But
Is there a draft methodology? What I'm really getting at is that we've spent a lot of time this afternoon talking about the relationship between state agencies and small business people and how important it is to have a two-way street of communication. Are the agents able to participate in helping to set the criteria or to give you any explanation for how the socioeconomic or regional differences affect their sales? And are you going to be measuring just liquor sales, or are you going to be measuring the maraschino cherries and the cigarettes too? I'm just trying to figure out, particularly with Senator Nelson sitting beside me representing about half of the rest of Oregon, to make sure that we're taking into account the rural differences and just that there has been a venue for the liquor agents to participate in setting the boundaries of the study.
Chair Johnson, there will there has been and there will continue to be a venue for the agents to interact. It's our anticipation that the vendor, whoever it is, will interview a wide variety of the agents and hear from them personally, their views on their compensation. Part of the budget note was to look at all the revenue streams coming into the business. In the past, some agents have chosen to identify only the liquor revenue as opposed to the overhead, when in fact there were more than one revenue stream in that business. Your own budget note, I believe, demonstrates that we are to look at all revenue streams.
Representative Smith. Thank you, Chair Johnson. This is an issue we worked on through the Ways and Means process. The one thing I would strongly encourage is that as you interview these agents, that it's truly random. If it's not truly, underline truly random, then you need to interview all of them, which I don't think is a possibility, because that's the only way you're going to get a study back that this, at least I know I can sign off on, is that it was random.
On behalf of the committee, if you could prepare us, because it's clear that maybe you didn't understand exactly why you were being asked to come here today, if you could prepare in the next week a quick memorandum that explains how the agents are being involved, get it to the professional staff to make sure that it fits the qualifications of randomness, that it takes into account the socioeconomic and geographic differences of where the stores are located, and that you put particular emphasis on how it is that you're involving the agents in a study of their business. I think much of what we've touched on this afternoon is that delicate relationship between agency intervention in the retention and creation of jobs and how those jobs create and retain themselves without government participation. And so if you could get that to us quickly, we'll make sure that both the House and the Senate committee have it.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to do that.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming on short notice. Representative Lynn.
So thank you very much for coming. I appreciate it. Could you give us some information about how many agencies do we have now, about 300 plus?
Madam Chair, Senator, Representative Lynn, we have approximately 244.
Okay.
We have more than that agencies, but we're beginning to see our first handful of agents that have two stores now.
Okay, and my question is, I'd like to know that the ratio of the nationalities who own the agencies. What I understand is mostly owned by their parents and goes to their children, and there's a very little participation by the minorities. I'd like to see some minority participations in the agency operating of the store. And is there any way you can give us some guidelines where we are so we can set the policies in the future?
If that isn't onerous, if you'd include just a breakdown of minority ownership of the stores when you send back the report, that would probably be the most useful.
Chair Johnson, Representative Lim, to the extent I'm able to capture that information, and I'm not sure that we do, I'll certainly check and give you what we have.
Great.
Yes, of course.
Thank you very much. The purpose in asking you here today was specifically the sideboards on the study and the methodology on the study. So if you could get that back quickly, that would be helpful.
I certainly will.
Thank you very much for coming. With that, two folks have volunteered to fall off the agenda today, and so I want to make sure that I note for the record that the Oregon Ports Group, in the interest of time, because Representative Lim has an issue that he wants to raise and we want to leave time for public comment. So the Oregon Ports Group, very generously offered to come back at another date, and the Economic Revitalization Team that was pretty important to this discussion has offered to come back at another date. I think Representative Lim and I will be speaking to what degree we can coordinate the efforts of these committees. Today was intended to really be a very high-level overview, and because of that, I'm sorry that we missed the comments by the Revitalization Team and the ports. I think they have something to contribute to our overall understanding of the universe of economic development. So we'll try to get information shared between the House and the Senate committee. But at this point, I would like to turn to my colleague, Representative Lim, who has an issue that he would like the joint committees to hear today, and perhaps with your agreement that we would consider acting on it today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate it. And my concern and issue I'd like to bring to this committee is that the hopefully next session, next year, that I'd like to see the Senate and the House Trade and Economic Committee join together. As a matter of fact, by statute, 171.805 is dictate that the Legislative Committee on Trade and Economic Development shall consist of the Speaker of the House of Representatives and whatever. By statute, we have to be the Joint Legislative Committee, like the Ways and Means. I think that way we will save our time and agency's time. They are going to separate the committee trying to explain the same thing. If we are together, according to this statute, it will save our time and agency's time, and we are more focused and streamlined. Why we are asking state agencies streamlining it, we are not doing it. I think it's appropriate for us to be a joint legislative committee, the Senate and then the House together. And what I'd like to propose, I'd like to give each member to give us an opinion on this issue, and I'd like to have some kind of a resolution so we can send a letter to the Speaker and President. So make sure that when we come back, hopefully next session, they can appoint a joint committee on this issue. The Ways and Means and the TNE is one of the top important committees in the state. I mean, we can produce better when we work together.
Well, with your indulgence, Representative Lim, I will pull my Senate colleagues first. Senator Moss Anderson, do you have a comment?
Well, I would need to get a little bit more information as to why it didn't happen this last time. I would like input from the President of the Senate for my information. I truly do believe it's much more efficient and more effective if we meet jointly. But I wouldn't want to act on it today until I got a little bit more information from the leadership in the Senate.
Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Yes, I think it would be far more efficient, and I would agree with Representative Lim.
Senator Lim, I would turn the gavel over to you to discuss it with your committee.
Okay, and Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Chair. I think it does sound like a good idea. You know, it sounds like it'd be more efficient. I do, you know, as Senator Moss Anderson has some reservations, just wanting to know all the peculiarities of it. I would hope that the members on this committee would be representative to the members in both minority and majority, because as we know, the Ways and Means is not chosen that way, so I would want that a fair representation. Thank you.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, I think it's a terrific idea, and I concur with Representative Holvey's concerns about the representation of the minority and the majority parties, but I think it's a great idea. I think you point out that we're urging state agencies to be more conservative of their time, and we should certainly do the same.
Yes, I would concur. That sounds like a very good idea, but I would also concur with the remarks of Senator Mona Sanderson that I would like more information as to why it wasn't done. To begin with, maybe there's a very good reason. I would like more information as well. So before I commit to saying I would like to do that, I would like to hear what that information is.
Thank you very much. Because we're all about inclusivity here, I would invite Mr. Salzgiver and appointee Director Repine to comment on whether or not you would give us any guidance or any thinking on how efficient this would be for you from the agency's perspective.
3 months ago.
Sure.
We have voted?
No.
You're right up here.
Madam Chair, committee members, my comment would be, I can't remember, I was trying to whisper over in the back row to figure out what constituted the separation, because at one time the committees were joined, and there was actually a staff person that was empowered to work on behalf of the joint committee effort. So somewhere along the line something had changed, so I think finding out the historic perspective of what constituted the change might have had good reasons then. As you evaluate it today, it may not have the same value for being divided. Maybe coming together would make sense. And I would support the representative's tremendous comment about, you know, we ask for efficiency and efficiencies, and time is of the essence, as you know, in this building that you're here for hopefully only 6 months, to get the best time and best information at once, as opposed to hearing it once but not twice, and hearing it differently possibly as you hear it twice. I think it could help expedite a lot of the discussions, not only on the economic issues, but other issues that the committee has jurisdiction over, I suspect. So, you know, to me, has a lot of practicalness to it as an agency.
Mr. Stoltzgeber, comment?
Chair Johnson, members of the committee, I would just echo Mr. Repine's thoughts. The efficiency is what's important. From an agency perspective, Lynn and I were just talking to each other about follow-up just from this hearing, and when you're trying to follow up two committees versus a single one, it's much more difficult.
Okay. Thank you. And as for my opinion, I concur that I think it certainly sounds like an efficacious suggestion. I think what I'm going to recommend, given that some members have expressed the reservation that they would simply like to have a little background, that both committees could take up your recommendation individually when we reconvene the next time after we've had a chance to get a little historical perspective. But I think you have heard from your colleagues, both House and Senate, an enthusiasm to proceed ahead. And I'll ask the professional staff to make sure that both committees have the opportunity to deal with the issue when they reconvene next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think this is an opportunity that we are having together today, House and Senate, in this interim committee. And I'd like to propose again sometime later part of this year. I'm hoping we can join one more time during the interim. Maybe during the time we might be able to study up those issues, and we might be able to pass our resolution and then send our letters to the each respective president and the speaker. And as I'm speaking to you, in the packet you should have a copy of a statute, why it should be, and when you have a next time, who can give us a historical perspective on this issue?
I can't answer that right now, but I'm sure such a person exists, and we'll rely on Mr. Keller to find that person.
And also, if I may, Joe Courtwright, who used to be the administrator of the House and Senate for more than 20-some years, maybe when he comes next time, he might be able to give us some perspective on this issue.
Thank you very much.
So okay. I'm willing to concur that we need more time to study, and then let's come to the conclusion when we meet together.
Good. Thank you. All right, before we turn to public testimony, I would just like to acknowledge the contributions of Robin Lamont in helping to pull together some of the concepts revolving around this very complex agency, and we are going to continue to rely on Robin's expertise to instruct our deliberations through the interim. So thank you, Mr. Keller and Mr. Golden. Thank you for your help today. And with that, we have one person signed up for public testimony. I would ask Mr. Estes to come forward, please.
Good afternoon. If you could state your name for the record, that would be great.
Good afternoon. My name is Wayne Essence. I'm a resident of Marion County, and I've heard one of the bookends raised here on a couple of occasions this afternoon to what I want to say had to do with living or family wage jobs. Now, I thank you for your interest in that specific language. We need good jobs. The other bookend that I propose to you is that we need full employment. This is not a popular concept, perhaps, but it is what is absolutely required for a healthy society. I moved to this state at a time when this city had 8% unemployment. That's the official number. We wouldn't dare want to guess that it was actually a double-digit number, which it probably was. I myself
moved to this state and was not on the unemployment rolls because I'd already exhausted all of my rights in another state. I went without income for over 2 years. Zero income. I represent 5 to 10% of Oregonians today. One of your whole entire representative districts is unemployed. What if it were yours? We need jobs, we need jobs, we need jobs. We don't need, in my poor estimation, we don't need more talk about the economy. We need to specifically talk about the joblessness. I don't care about the economy. I care about my own welfare. So I'm calling for an end to both unemployment and underemployment. And I'll leave you with that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Estes. Other questions for Mr. Estes? Thank you very much. I've just been notified that Mr. Vincent, Steve Vincent, on behalf of the Vista would like to, on behalf of the Economic Development Association would like to.
I just want to put my name on the list because I heard you were executing names off that list.
The dead are risen. Mr. Knapp has just come back.
Steve Vincent, I do work for Vista Utilities, but I'm also the president of the Oregon Economic Development Association. Just wanted to introduce myself to the members of this committee. And, we're an organization that's quite a resource for both you, your colleagues, and for the department. We have participated in a variety of activities. You heard about OregonProspector.com, which is a program that our association is responsible for continuing to run on a day-to-day basis. And we also do an awful lot of business recruitment activity on behalf of the state as well. That's probably the niche I've spent most of my time in on behalf of this association the last couple of years, namely a trip to California last week to meet with businesses that are considering a move to Oregon, and a trip to the East Coast earlier in the month of January, another place that we had a good opportunity to meet with businesses for the purpose of capturing some of their expansions or relocations to the Western United States. One thing that I just, a lot of different things I heard you say and ask questions of over the course of this hearing, and I might just try and touch on a couple of them. You asked the question, how do we differentiate between the priorities of recruiting? What sectors are we trying to recruit? How do we decide? Well, one example, last week as I'm meeting with businesses or walking a trade show, I think we make those decisions fairly quickly as we walk through about 1 million square feet of different businesses. Some of those will never be able to land in the state of Oregon, either because of our workforce, because of our size, because of environmental issues. There are a variety of reasons that we place the priorities that we do as we do the recruitment. And I myself, in representing the state at these various functions, do that mostly with the insight of the department. One last thing I'll just say, when you asked about the Joint Committee, I think it's Joe Courtright was probably the last administrator for a Joint Committee, and I think you all know who he is, and I can even remember his office in a closet down at the end of the hallway across from the Secretary of State's office. My boss back then, Representative Johnson, I think was a member of that committee, and it seemed to be effective then, and I encourage you to look into it again. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Vincent? Senator Nelson.
From your viewpoint, if you want to do this without revealing any biases, what are the strengths and the weaknesses that you see in the department?
Well, I think one of the greatest strengths, and certainly last session, our association advocated for the department because of their activity in the regions. They're very strong. A lot of our members, majority of our members, say, you know, there's nothing wrong. There's nothing structurally wrong with this agency. They deliver their services well. You know, that the local partners that I work with in Southern Oregon don't have a bone of contention. Sure, on a case-by-case basis, there will be a recruitment that we're involved with that we think that it could have gone better, or we might have lost one, but it's really no fault of the administrative function of the agency and the people that they have in the field. And I think you all hear this because you know who they are. Joe Miles in Eastern Oregon, they do a great job in representing the agency. A lot of the local economic development activity is dependent on the local agencies to see that through. And earlier a question was asked, how does a community decide on whether or not they want a recruitment? We saw a project come to Medford. A company wanted 1 million square feet of warehouse space for 5 jobs. Well, I think that we pretty much decided as a community we weren't going to respond to that that recruitment. And so I think the communities have the authority on their own to make that decision. And then the Joe Miles equivalent to our region says, great, if that's what you've decided, then so be it. So I think that there's still a lot of local control, and I think that the agency does well in supporting that.
Joe Miles just picked up, I think, 2 new industries in our part of the country. One of them, 60 jobs or something like that, which is huge for us. I mean, she does a great job from my viewpoint.
Right.
You know, like the incoming director didn't know that. She does an excellent job. And
we like our guy, too.
I guess I know I'm borrowing time here. I guess the last comment I'll make, though, and back to the gentleman I worked for, Eldon Johnson, I can remember in the 91 session when he sat on the Ways and Means sub that had the higher ed budget, he was very frustrated with the lack of information that was coming to the Ways and Means Committee. And I can recall, you know, driving back to Medford with him over the weekends, you know, his frustration with that. But I think this agency was very open, very willing to discuss, you know, the appropriation that you make to them and how it's used. And there's quite a disparity between what I saw then with that particular agency and what I see you in front of you now and in the last session, and their willingness to you know, ask for your input and pretty much, you know, open arms. Here's what we've got, and here's what we do. And there's nothing hiding here, and so I guess I encourage you to trust what you see.
Great. What was that about?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to make a comment as Senator Nelson started out with his concern about water, and I share that concern of having drinking water and enough water for irrigation and all, but in our economy in the Northwest, one of our most important resources and one of our advantages has been low-cost electricity, and I have listened and not heard any comments from the economic folks about, you know, our capacity and our infrastructure for electricity as well, and maintaining that as being a really essential part of our future economy, and do we have our, you know, eye on that ball? And I just think that's something for this committee to also think about, is our electrical capacity and keeping our costs low for not only our citizens but our industries.
It absolutely is, and that's why on the Senate draft interim work plan we have this infrastructure piece that we've now added water to, and with your advice we'll have electricity, availability of electric power to that as well. Senator Monsanto.
Madam Chair, thank you. Is transportation on that list?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Telecommunications?
No, but it is now. All right. A couple of closing comments. Given the absence of a complete interim work plan, that has given rise to a great deal of unnecessary angst, I'm going to make public the draft Senate work plan within the next week. It remains a draft. This is a very dynamic document. We had to come up with a work plan in a very short period of time, and because of the complexities of OECDD, there were those that felt slighted that they were not on this first agenda, and so we'll get that draft work plan for the Senate side out and published. I want to thank the public and the committee and the professional staff, both from the agency and the committee professional staff, for sitting through a very long, information-rich meeting. The rest of the Senate meetings will not be this long, but this seemed to be an opportunity to get a very high-level perspective of what's happened in the agency. agency since we adjourned, and a prospective look forward, and hopefully we've had a good exchange of information here, but I appreciate the committee's courtesy in staying. Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this question is to you and to Chair Liam. I'm wondering, are we going to be meeting together in the future, and if not, why not?
I can answer you from my perspective. They were assigned as two separate committees, but I think given the experience that we've had today, the commonality of interest, the efficiency to the agency, that it was my intention to speak with Representative Lim outside of this meeting, and also to check with the burden on committee staff to see about an amalgamation, just work out the technical mechanics, and see if we could meet more often together.
Great, I would like that.
And I'd like to concur, and I'd like to discuss with you, at least I proposed that the if we have a 4 or 5 meetings, at least I'd like to have one more meeting by the toward the end of it, if not every time. But it's up to our members which directions we want to go, and I will discuss with our House members and which directions they want to go, and certainly after that we'll discuss with you. On that issue.
I think you hear openness on the part of both of the chairs to find the efficiencies in working together rather than having separate parallel track meetings, and I see the professional staff at the agency saying yes, that would be a good thing. Okay, I will give someone a last chance for the final comment for today's meeting.
And Madam Chair, final comment is not necessarily a comment, since two members out of this room while we were discussing on the joint committee, I'd like to give them the opportunity to mention that they possibly next session, instead of having a divided TNE committee, we are hoping to have a joint TNE committee, House and Senate. That's according to the statute, it's dictated we should have that committee.
So the opinion of the rest of the committee, both House and Senate, was to take it under advisement, have the opportunity to get a little historical perspective, confer among ourselves, and then come back. And if we, generally the overall reaction was favorable, if it turns out that we do want to write a letter, we actually have the action item at a future meeting.
Yeah, I'm always a means person, so that sounds good to me.
Good.
Okay. With that, and with 10 minutes to spare, we made it. It feels like a long forced march, but the Senate committee stands adjourned.
Good. Okay. I'll see you next time.